orders, I mean, the 20-year period is going to cover most of the time period when the child would be getting support anyway. So at some period, it's going to expire, and either they've made the collection efforts or not. So, Madam Chair, members, I'll offer the A2 amendment to change the bill from what would be a perpetual judgment into a 20-year judgment only for child support orders.
Senator Betzel offers the A2 amendment as an author's amendment to put the bill into the shape he would like it to be in. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
And then, Madam Chair, the A1 amendment was requested by legal aid. This is language dealing with the redirection of child support, and it adds some language, again, primarily on page 5. If you look at the language starting at page 5.12, it says that the obligee or the obligor may contest a redirection on certain limited grounds. There's only two listed. That the child did not reside with a caregiver, or that the under an out-of-home placement there's no plan to maintain a plan for reunification. Well, this one adds a third one, that the redirection is not in the best interest of the child, and I think that makes a lot of sense. It also provides, as I say, that they it adds on page 6, line 3, it clarifies the duty of the public authority in determining that the caregiver no longer receives support when the order is to expire. So I think that the amendments proposed by legal aid are good ones. I'm told that the agency has no problems with this. Obviously, if they do, I need to hear from them, but I'm told that they're okay with it. So I'll offer the A1 amendment.
On the A1 amendment, any questions or discussions? Is there anybody here who would like to testify on the A1 amendment? If you are already in agreement on this, you do not have to testify, only if you object to it. There being none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, that's the bill, and I know DHS is here to respond to any questions or issues you may have. I believe legal aid is here mainly for the A1 amendment. If there's anybody else here, I guess they would have the opportunity to testify at this time if they wish to do so.
Members, questions for Senator Betzel on Senate File 2562. Senator Betzel?
Madam Chair, this has been requested by the Committee on Health, Housing, and Family Security. So I will move that Senate File 2562 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Health, Housing, and Family Security.
On that motion, any further discussions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Betzel. Is Senator Marty here yet?
He's here, yeah.
All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I have Senate File 907, which is a relative caregiver. The Senate Council caught the fact we were using caretaker and caregiver interchangeably and corrected that. But relative caregiver consent system for people when you have a grandparent or some relative who is taking care of a child and has to do things like get the child enrolled in school, get them to medical appointments and things like that, because right now the schools cannot, without legal authority, disclose anything about the student's progress or anything. You use the parent's permission for anything because they're not the legal guardians and they're not always in a situation where they can reach the parents. And so this provides an alternative form. Peter Banovitz, an attorney who works with the kinship caregivers people to go through the bill for you, and we're happy to answer questions, but this is designed to be a simple way that parents, that non-parent guardians who are relatives and are taking care of them, as many situations are these days, have an ability to give authorization for school and medical things, and it does not overrule the parents. If the parents decide they don't like this, they can still step in. And it's something where you may not have a chance to get power of attorney or guardianship type of things cleared up ahead of time. And I'll turn it over to Mr. Banovitz because he's able to explain it much better than me. I understand the problem and how this would help it, but he can deal with it better.
Madam Chair, should we adopt the A1? I believe this is a committee of origin.
Senator Betzold, I was waiting for Senator Marty to ask for the A1 amendment. You do have an A1 amendment.
Thank you.
Would you like us to do
that? Senator Betzold, I appreciate that.
I'll offer the A1 amendment as an author's amendment.
Senator Betzold offers the A1 amendment as an author's amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Mr. Is it Manovich?
Banovitz, Your Honor.
Would you spell your last name? Because our staff here has to put that in the record, and then that way we can all pronounce it correctly.
Thank you. B as in boy, A-N-O, V as in Victor, E-T, Z as in zebra.
Banovitz.
Peter. Banovitz. Yes.
Banovitz. Welcome to the committee. Identify yourself for the record, and as you go through the bill, just integrate the A1 amendment into the bill.
Yes.
It's just language changes.
Right. For the record, again, my name is Peter Banovitz. I'm a private attorney, also a member of the board of directors of a statewide nonprofit organization, Minnesota Kinship Caregivers Association. And we urge the passage of this bill and as amended to help the caregivers and the children that they are caring for and actually raising on a short-term situation to enable them to get medical care for the child or the children and enroll them in school and get necessary educational services as necessary when the parents are not available, despite the effort of the caregiver to locate the parent and get the parent's authorization. It's a situation that arises more often than you would think or expect. There are over 70,000 children in Minnesota being raised by non-parents, by other caregivers, many of whom are grandparents. And on the short term, before they are able to get legal custody through the court procedure, as you know, with young children, situations arise, and especially a medical emergency. And if they take the child to an emergency room or to a clinic to get medical care, and they do not have the legal authorization from a parent or a court order, oftentimes the medical care will not be provided. So this is really to benefit the child and to enable the actual caregiver to get the services that are necessary for the child.
So, Mr. Banovitz, are you going to walk us through the bill? Or are you just going to testify on the bill?
Yes.
I could have Ms. Pontius walk us through the bill, too, if you...
I can go through it. I mean, it provides the definition of the qualified relative, the conditions when the authorization can be obtained, when the child is voluntarily in the custody, the de facto custody of the caregiver, and the parent cannot be located. It does not infringe on the right of the parent to withdraw the consent that would otherwise be given to the caregiver if the parent objects, but they must do so. It's relatively, there's a limit, there's a time limit on it of up to 1 year, so it's not indefinite and does not go for an extended period of time.
Explain that. Subdivision 4.
Sure. Under Subdivision 4 in the initial section, the decision of the caregiver to get the care can be overridden, as I indicated earlier, by the parent or the legal custodian of the child, so they can override it. But it's really more for an emergency situation or for a relatively short-term situation when the parent or parents cannot be located and some necessary medical or educational service is necessary for the child. The bill also provides the authorization, the affidavit, and the notices that must be provided. It also provides for some limitation of liability for the medical provider or the provider of the educational service. It limits their liability if they, in good faith, rely upon the authorization that is provided under this statute. And, you know, anecdotally, I mean, I have had clients who have tried to get, you know, non-parents who have tried to get medical care, emergency medical care for a child, and the medical facility literally would not provide it unless or until the caregiver provided some legal authorization indicating that they had the legal authority to do so. And in one case, I had a grandmother literally had to run to her car. Unfortunately, she had a legal authorization in the glove compartment of her car, which she then had to run back into the emergency room with, and then the care could be provided. So it's necessary, and it's really a win-win situation for the children primarily, but also for those people that are actually caring for the child.
Maybe Ms. Pontius can go through some of the sections. I mean, the termination of authority, I don't know, sorry, I got in a side conversation. Termination of authority, it lasts only a year. You could renew it, but then, or when the child goes back to the parent or ceases to reside with the relative and so on. And the notice of termination, the acting parent has to pass it on to the school and the medical providers and anyone who is notified that they had this authority in the first place, and that those people, the school district or the medical provider, if they are relying on this this affidavit, they are not liable if they do something in good faith and then they find out later that the thing had been overridden or whatever. We have certain limits on, like, HIV testing. Controlled substance testing does not give them authority because they're separate things in the law. It simply has to be notarized, and the warning is that you're subject to punishment if you lie on anything in the thing. Then they spell out the entire form in the end of Section 1, Subdivision 12. They spell out the form and all the warnings with it, and that's basically the substance of the bill.
Senator Marty, I'm a little bit, both of you are talking and walking through the bill, I'm just having a hard time breathing, reacting to it, because I feel like it seems to be so much for a care provider to have to put all these pieces in place. And I understand the intent, but are we creating an undue complication that's going to add an additional burden to some family care providers who are suddenly now having to care for this group of children? I mean, I'm trying to imagine the scenario where this will work, but it just seems like it's so legalistic. And so how do we – is this going to be more helpful, or do you think that we might be creating some unintended consequences here?
Madam Chair, I will take a stab at that. I'm not either the attorney or the person who works in this, but the problem is, I remember in my own situation as a kid, we had some permanent foster kids living with us, and I remember every year that we had no legal authority over them, though it was a permanent arrangement. It had been that way. They did things looser that way. And back then, my parents would consent to all the medical care. They were the guardians. And they were able to consent to that. In many cases where a child goes into substance abuse treatment or something, and then the grandparents take over the grandchild, and they don't have a chance, or through a whole combination of circumstances, they can't even reach their own child. The parent of the child is gone, and if you need to consent to permission slips so the kid can participate in a field trip, if you need to even get them enrolled in the school, you may not be able to do that. This is supposed to be a very simple, you fill out an affidavit that's saying, I'm the relative, I'm the grandparent or whomever, I'm the relative who has custody of the child, and for this period of time, I'm the one who's able to make these decisions. It's supposed to be simple. And because of that, it's not giving them any more authority than they need. It only gives them these limited types of authority, but it's supposed to be a simple one document that I can go to a notary, get it notarized, saying that I have the authority to do this, and then I can get my kid, my grandkid, or whoever, into the care they need. So it's supposed to be simple, though the form is all, I think any legal document like that's going to be that way, a power of attorney. I remember when my kids were overseas and they signed it over to us. It's a long form and very simple purpose for it, though.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Marty, I appreciate you working with this group of constituents. I know a couple of years ago, I think the first year I was here, I worked with them on a different bill, but, trying to address a similar concern. And I can really relate to the concern because I can recall having clients where, say a child would be injured in an accident, and that's how they would become someone who'd be in my accident or in my office. And I'd find that there were kids out there who were living in kind of a legal no man's land, but the circumstances usually were something like this. The child had been left with the grandparent because the parent, whatever the parent's personal circumstances were, they really wanted the grandparent to take responsibility for the child, and for a number of whatever the circumstances varied, but they were not wanting to take that full-time responsibility for their child. But if the grandparent tried to do something to make the situation legal by going and having themselves appointed a guardian or something like that, it would often mean that that would bring the whole situation into the radar of the court system and the human services system, and there might be some repercussions for that parent. And so then the threat would be, if you do anything like that, I'll come and take the child back. And so the grandparent was often feeling like they needed, they didn't dare do anything to help the child, that, in terms of medical care sometimes the child needed, or anything that would bring the focus of the system kind of to the attention of the child. Now, the problem that I see with doing this approach, the flip side of the coin, is sometimes there's a reason to have attention brought to the child in terms of making sure that the living situation is appropriate and that the child's needs are being met. And, there may be some legal circumstances that need to be addressed. And this is such a dramatic change. I'm not sure what the courts think of it, what human services think of it. If you can really do something this informally and how that's really going to work, it's such a big change. I'm not sure. But it certainly is a big, big policy issue. I would think it's not a small change in terms of how these children would be dealt with.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Marty, in reading quickly your bill, I know that on the first page you talk of qualified relatives, and I'm assuming these qualified relatives would be the subject of an authorization affidavit that would be allowed to be responsible for these decisions, but would it just be one person designated in this list of qualified relatives, or would it be a number of them in the event that one couldn't be reached?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, the child has to be living with them, so presumably it could be a grandmother and grandfather, but it says one, so presumably the affidavit would be just in the grandmother's or the grandfather's name. But it has to be, in other words, it can't be, three uncles of the kid are taking care of the kid, unless the three uncles all lived in the same household with the child.
Yeah, Madam Chair, the reason why I asked the question is I was wondering if there might be a potential conflict between some of these qualified designated relatives, and would that ever come into being? The other question I had was on page 2, line 25. You made mention of the child ceases to reside with a relative. And is reside the proper definition of what you want? Or in the case of a separated or divorced parents, would it be the child ceases to be in the custody of a parent, or could you expand on that for me? I'm trying to get a
Senator direction. Marty?
I'd rather have Mr. Banovitz respond to the second part, but to the first part of what you were saying and what Senator Olson was saying, this is intended to be not to try and put a little formality into it so that the parent has the caregiver has limited authority. I mean, they can't make any big-term, long-term decisions, but they can get the kid enrolled in the school. If the parent drops off the child with the grandparent and I'm fleeing, or I'm leaving, I'm doing whatever, and I'll be back and they don't come back, whatever, you want to be able to have the grandparents enroll the kid in the local school. So it's meant to have that very limited authority, and it's not meant to be a permanent thing, and it's meant that the parent can come in and say, hey, wait a minute, I'm back now, I don't want this to happen, and I can override at any time the decisions that the grandparents made. So it's meant to be a little bit of formality into it in a very simple process, so because, again, in the complication of people's lives, when all of a sudden grandparents are left with a child.
Madam Chair,
Senator
in that regard, in the event that on line 25, page 2, the child ceases to reside, if there was a court order that delegated that child to the custody of, does the residence of the child trump the custody direction of the court?
No. This,
Senator
Madam Chair,
Marty?
Senator Limmer, this won't trump anything. I mean, right. It just gives them the authority to do it unless there's something else. In other words, as you can see, this doesn't take away any of the rights of the parent or guardian in Subdivision 3, and it explicitly says the parent can override this at any time. They can say, no, I don't want my kids to go on that field trip, or I don't want them to get that medical care. So it does not trump any of that. It's simply to say that the kid is not, I think Senator Olson described it as a legal limbo that the kids are in. You want to try and give it so they at least have somebody making decisions.
Madam Chair,
Senator Limmer,
in the event there would be a dispute, is there anything in your bill that would recognize the best interests of the child versus a potential competing interest of the parent or custodian or the delegated relative or interested party?
Madam Chair, Senator
Marty?
Limmer, on page 2, line 14, the one where I was talking about the contravening decision by the parent, it says it is superseded the grandparent in this case. Decision is superseded by a decision of the parent if the decision of the parent does not jeopardize the life, health, safety, or whatever. In other words, the presumption is that the parents are doing what's in the best interest of the child and they trump the grandparent's interest unless those things are the case.
Well, Madam Chair, does that mean that the best interest of the child is based on the intent of that adult, or is it a court-defined best interest of the child?
Court-defined.
Mr. Banovitz?
I'm not the attorney.
Well, I would say that the legal authority of the parent would presumptively, and under the terms of the bill and the statute, would trump or contravene or override whatever authority the actual caregiver has under the statute.
But
so, I mean, you wouldn't get into a detailed best interest analysis. Simply, if the legal custodian says no, that's it.
But Senator Limmer, I think that what this does is lays out the elements so that if there is, you know, a dispute and it somehow ends up before a judge, then the grandparents, I'm presuming, would point to or try to prove that these elements existed. And so your question is, this is fine for it to be here, but do we need to spell out the best interest of the child as the standard in this statute to give adequate protection for the child?
Right.
So,
well, Madam Chair, Senator Marty suggested that this was on relatively day-to-day decisions that have to be made, the enrollment in a school. But how far could it go? Could it, if the parent wasn't available, Could someone with this authority make life and death decisions if the child was in a hospital? And then it gets into a much more serious circumstance. And then does this, if this passed, would this statute cover those decisions, or would it be, I don't know where it goes then.
Madam Chair?
Mr. Banovitz?
Well, I think it's spelled, I can't immediately find it, but I think it spells out that these would be, you know, non-life-threatening medical decisions, you know, in response to your question. I think it tries to, you know, limit the authority, but yet deal with the reality of a caregiver, you know, dealing with a child who may be very sick, you know, need medical care or is about to go into school or needs to get into school or some, you know, important educational services that need to be provided. And they are actually, the child is living with them, they are caring for the child, and the parent is not available despite their best efforts to find the parent. So it just, it provides the limited legal authority for education or health care to the caregiver to accomplish that and get it done.
I can see, Madam Chair, where
Senator Lemmer,
where this, if passed, this could be revisited many times in the years to come, on competing interests of parents going through divorces, the ability to control or not control the distant relationship, the competition for the child's interests. I could see it going in a lot of different directions, and then even having a potential criminal sanction. And I was just wondering, is there a reference you make on the criminal sanction? What kind of criminal sanction is there?
Madam
Ms.
Chair?
Pontius, do you know where the criminal sanction may be
Madam
in the
Chair,
bill?
Madam, there is nothing specifically in this bill. I think it would be just like a general fraud statute or forgery where if you execute a document that has legal significance, you can be guilty of a crime.
Senator Betzel and then Senator Olson.
Two questions. First of all, Madam Chair, Senator Marty, we were given the example of, you know, a relative who had to give emergency care for a child. Is it possible that this could wind up in an absurd situation where, you know, you've got a child sitting with a grandma, you know, for the day because mom's out shopping. We don't know where she is. She hasn't got her cell phone. And grandma's got to get the kid to a doctor. And they say, well, you know, we need to have a caretaker authorization affidavit. You know, I mean, at some point, you know, are we going to need this for any temporary caregiving?
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, no, because the authorization is only intended, page 1, line 24, the bottom line of first page. These authorizations are only if the child is residing with the relative caregiver on a full-time basis. This is not meant for I'm taking care of the kid today. This is meant is for somebody the longer-term decisions. And I don't want to minimize this because I think, Senator Lemmer, you recognize if you're taking care of a kid and they go to the hospital for something, it turns out to be a big thing. In effect, these are the temporary caregivers right now. They're the de facto caregivers, and we're saying they're not overriding the parents, but we don't have access to the parents. And so let's make the presumption here that this is I realize this could be, and I'm not trying to minimize the complexity of now. I actually had one complexity I want to add to it in a minute, but but I wanted to resolve what Senator Betzel was asking.
Well, Senator Betzel. So Madam Chair, and Senator Marty, then, if the child is residing with the same grandparent for the summer, does that mean that this is appropriate then if we have a longer period of time?
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, this is meant to be a situation where the child ends up with that relative with the consent of the parents. The parents drop them off. Or whatever, and the relative caregiver is unable to contact the parent. It's not meant for we're babysitting or we're watching the child for the summer. This is meant for somebody where, in most of these cases, I think the parents are in some sort of crisis or another, and they're leaving their they're not putting their kids up for adoption or not turning over custody, but on the other hand, they're just basically abandoning the kids with somebody else, grandma, or somebody they hope will take care of them.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Betzel,
then if a parent, say, in the military and gets deployed on short notice, then this would apply?
Senator Marty or Mr. Benevitz?
It's not intended for that, and I would assume that some, you know, better planning would be done under those circumstances, or maybe there's relatively immediate contact with the parent even if they're deployed. But, it's not intended for that situation.
Madam Chair,
Senator Betzel,
a technical matter. I notice on page 1, line 9, we define a term qualified relative, and we also define the term qualified relative on page 5.35. I've read through the bill as best as I could. It appears that the only place that the term qualified relative appears on page 4, line 10, as part of the affidavit. It seems to me most of the bill refers to the term of relative caregiver. So I'm just wondering if the term qualified relative, as defined, should not be relative caregiver instead of qualified.
Yeah. Senator Betzel, both Ms. Pontius and I have that circled.
Okay.
And I think that we're Senator Marty and Mr. Benevitz,
yes,
will have to comment on this, but my assumption is that wherever there is the word relative in front of caregiver, they would like the word qualified to be inserted so that we're consistent.
Madam Chair, either that way or the way Senator Betzel was preferring to do it, the definition ought to match the terminology. I don't think it matters which way you use.
Okay.
It's not going to help me. Madam Chair, just on a cursory reading, but I defer to counsel, it seems to me that if we just changed qualified relative to relative caregiver, that seems to track with most of the language concepts in the bill. But again, counsel may see it differently. So,
Ms. Pontius is going to ponder that one, and she'll come back to you, Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, I think the best way would be just to put on page 1, line 23, after that line 23, insert clause 1, the person is a qualified relative. Because the term relative caretaker is kind of used in a more descriptive sense throughout the bill. So I think if you just put there that this says the person is a qualified relative, then renumber the remaining clauses. And then you don't have to keep repeating qualified relative all the way through the bill.
Senator Betzel, you want to move that language?
I'll move it. And does anything need to be done on page 5, line 35? I mean, this is a notice that is being given. So I don't know if anything further has to be done there. But I'll make that the amendment, Madam Chair. And if counsel needs to, edit to make it fit, I'll add that as part of my motion.
All right. Senator Betzel moves the insertion of the language as read by Ms. Pontius. To insert, Ms. Pontius, can you repeat it?
Madam Chair, members, just be on page 1 after line 23, insert a clause 1. The person is a qualified relative, semicolon, and then just renumber the remaining clauses.
Senator Marty, is that okay? Any further discussions, members? On Senator Betzel's motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Senator Marty, when you say that the child is residing with the relative caregiver on a full-time basis, how is full-time basis defined? Or just do people just kind of know that?
Madam Chair, I would say they just kind of know that. I mean, if the kid is staying with the grandparents 1 week and an uncle or somebody else the next week, I would say that's not a – It's not that. I would say people know what full time is, but obviously you could get into.
And is there a durational limit contemplated in the bill?
Madam Chair, it's a 1 year. You'd have to renew it after a year. The assumption is it's not going to last that long, but there are cases where it could last longer than that, so you'd have to get renewed. And you have to notify at the end of that period. You, the relative caregiver, have to notify the school and everybody you gave the notice that you have the authority in the first place to.
And there's no initial durational basis that the child would have had to live with the relative caregiver on a full-time basis for a minimum of a week before this clicks in? I mean, it's as soon as they come in the door?
Madam Chair, there is none intended that way. There was not one thought of that way. Maybe it needs to be one, but it seems to me if you're in October, November, and the parent is whatever, for whatever crisis they're in, they just drop off the kid at the relative's house and so on and take care of him, I'm going to be gone. It seems to me you might want the kid in school the next day or within a day or two to get things back to normal as quick as possible. So I don't know that you do that, but again, I think this is meant as a short-term, quick thing, and I think it would probably be better not to have that, but
of course, I mean, maybe. It gets nullified.
And then, Senator Marty, the how do some of these grandparents know about this authorization, this affidavit?
May I speak?
Mr. Benevitz.
It would be the information and you know, sort of a form authorization would have to be, I mean, like the organization that I work with would have to take it upon themselves to get the word out and inform and educate people of what's available and what, you know, what services or what possibilities are available given your situation. Once a form was developed, I mean, I could see it going maybe to self-help centers at various courthouses at district court administration, where people sometimes look for forms or help or information. I can't comment beyond that, but certainly, and there are various organizations around the state that work with these relative caregivers, and the information and forms would be disseminated to them.
And Madam Chair, I also picture a school district that has parents coming in and the grandparents coming in and say, I want to register my kid. Well, what authority do you have? And, well, we're the grandparents, and parents just disappeared. And, oh, well, then you should fill out one of these. And they would tell them how to get access to information on this. I think it'd be a variety of ways and a lot of, I mean, they'd be stumbling into it because they were trapped and they had no other way to help give authority for the child.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really sympathize with the situation here that grandparents are in, but I have some real significant concerns about this bill because it's, first of all, I'd point out on line 1.19, you're basically giving the same authority that a parent would have, and then it says, you know, including enrolling kids in school and so forth, but bottom line, it's an open-ended authority according to the way this is written. And that's a lot. It says the same authority as a custodial parent of the child to exercise care, physical custody, and control of the child, including authorities and so forth. But the way it's written, it says basically they have the same authority that a parent would have. And we have a system in place right now. I mean, we just assume that parents have the rights to exercise authority over their kids and that they'll act in the best interest of the child. That doesn't always happen, but it's a basic presumption built into our law. I don't think we want to change that presumption, you know, in the absence of some good reason to believe a parent is not parenting, you know, so their child is safe. I don't think we want to change that. But now we're basically taking that same presumption and giving it to all the relatives of that child in terms of the ability to take control of that child with just based on their word, you know, their affidavit that they fill out without anyone taking a look, whether it's the courts or human services or anybody, about whether that's an appropriate situation for that child to continue to live in. Now, the reality is they may be living there anyway. And they, like I said, these kids are sometimes in legal limbo, and they may be deliberately, for whatever reasons the family may have, not wanting to involve human services and so forth. But this is going to be making that a lot easier to avoid that kind of analysis and avoid the court's involvement and perhaps giving a legal guardianship. Relatives are usually given preference. You know, if the child is living there and they want to be a guardian, or they want to continue that, to have that living situation, they're generally going to be the preferred placement for the child. But now you're kind of taking this the whole infrastructure we have out of the picture with just based on someone's word. You know, so I worry about that. And there I can see lots of competing relatives. When you have a parent that goes away for whatever reason, you may have two sets of grandparents, you may have, you know, siblings and different relatives all wanting to take control of that child. And that's kind of where the courts get involved and figure out what the best placement should be. So I don't know.
Madam Chair.
Senator Marty.
Senator Olson, in that case, two things. One, remember that at line 18, the caregiver has been given custody of the child voluntarily by the parent. In other words, this is not, I agree with you, we don't want to be having one parent say, we're taking, one grandparent and we're taking custody of the child. But if we're intending this, and I recognize you have to look for beyond what the intent is, but also what other options might happen. But where the child is being dropped off, take care of him, I'm leaving, kind of thing. Or I'll be back tomorrow and they never come back or whatever. This is not meant, this is immediately overridable by the parent stepping in and saying we want it. And yes, if this caregiver isn't appropriate, I would argue they're probably better off than the parent is. If the parent is dumping them off there, the parent feels this person can take better care of the child. This is not meant to get around anything else. It's meant to say in temporary situations when we don't know if the parent is going to be back next week or not.
Senator Olson, would you be more comfortable if somehow Ms. Pontius could help craft some language to narrow the authorization to school and medical? Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, I would be more comfortable with that. But I also think, I mean, I would support an expedited way to try to help grandparents in this situation or other siblings, you know, relatives get their legal rights established. But I'm concerned about something that, and Senator Marty, you always think the best of people. I just think you do. I mean, you just have a good heart and you think the best of people. And I'm sure that the gentleman sitting with you and the other grandparents who are bringing this forward are really, truly wanting to do the best thing for their grandchildren. And I understand their dilemma. But when we put something into law, we have to think about all the possible ways it could be used. And you're just relying on the person who fills out the affidavit's word. You have no oversight that any of this that they're having to say is actually accurate. And so that's my concern, you know, that there's just no oversight in the – and, yes, a person who's willing to care for that child is definitely a better place than someone dumping him whatever, and I think they should have all the presumptions. But I'm just concerned about that lack of oversight. And then my one other question is paying for medical. Is it presumed that under this bill that the child would qualify for – health coverage through the grandparents, or would the grandparents have the right to enroll the child in any programs that the child might qualify for? I'm just, again, that was another big issue with kids in these situations, and I'm just wondering how that would work and what the thinking about that was.
Senator Marty or Mr. Benevitz?
Madam Chair, only thing I wanted to respond to Senator Olson is I think it would be appropriate to limit the authority. What we were talking about, you're right, the language here says the same authority as a custodial parent. We were talking primarily about some of the daily functions you need, the getting the kid into school and getting them the medical care and giving them permission for things like field trips, things like that, things that a parent needs to be able to do on a day-to-day basis, and so limiting that authority would be appropriate. I'll have Mr. Banovitz speak about the issue about the medical care.
Mr. Banovitz?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Olson. Generally, if the grandparents or other caregiver does not have, you know, court-ordered legal and/or physical custody of the child, it's virtually impossible for them to get them on their own health care coverage. So I generally agree that, and I think you have a good point. The word including is too broad, and I think that really the intent, the overall intent, is to limit it. And it also, there's, and I can't point you to a specific line or section, but I know that it's clearly not intended to give, you know, legal and physical custody to the grandparent. It's just it or the relative. It's just, it's this limited authority to get medical care or to enroll and get educational services as necessary.
So the intention here is that even though the authorized qualified caregiver has the ability to consent to, say, the medical treatment, they have not, this bill is not going to put them in the position of consenting to taking on the liability for the medical treatment or the medical procedure. Mr. Benevitz or Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, that's the way I'd read it. And therefore, I mean, it gets to the whole point. If the child is needing significant medical care, they're going to have to do it, whether they approach social services or whether they go and ask for custody or they, in other words, when it gets to be a more complicated thing, they're going to need a more detailed authority than this bill would give them.
Senator Betzel.
A little while ago, I presented a bill from the Department of Human Services to make it easier, to redirect child support without it going to court. If it's quite clear where the child – now, this bill here, I don't think deals with child support issues, but if you take those two bills together, if they become law, somebody can basically fill out one of these affidavits and send it in and say, okay, I've got the child now. Send the child support to me. Now, I don't know if that's good or not. Maybe it's consistent. Maybe it's not. But it's just – I think something we ought to keep in the back of their minds that, you know, somebody's going to abuse this at some point and get child support redirected based upon the affidavit. And does that complicate things? I don't know. It doesn't necessarily, you know, kill either bill or impair it, but I think we just got to realize that there are things that are out there that, you know,
sure,
we're changing.
Let's see. Senator Olson, do you want to, or Senator Betzel, does a member of the committee want to move, if Ms. Pontius can come up with the language, to narrow the language subdivision 2 to medical and educational purposes only? Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, are we going to hear from anyone else, like in Human Services, or is there anyone else, like from the courts, or someone who is planning to weigh in on what impact this might have?
Is there anybody else here who would like to testify for or against this bill?
We've talked to the death.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm willing to move that amendment because I think that would be an improvement. And besides, Senator Marty has said that's really what the intent of the bill is anyway. I'm still not sure that I'm comfortable one way or the other knowing how I feel about this without hearing more about what kind of a broader impact this might have.
The department must be listening because Senator Betzel just presented his bill. So,
I don't know if they're still here, though.
And if they're not here, I would ask them to take a look at Senator Betzel's bill and then take a look at this bill in the context of that bill to see if we've created any complications. Ms. Pontius, do you have the language of the amendment? So Senator also moves the following language.
Madam Chair, members, on page 1, line 19, delete everything after child. And on line 20, delete control of the child, including authority. And then on page 2, on line 34, delete the second comma that appears after school and insert end. And on line 35, delete everything after providers and delete line 36 up to the all of line 36. And on page 3, line 1, delete everything before the period.
Madam Chair, what does this do again? This narrows it down to...
Senator Betzel, this language narrows the authority down to just for education and medical purposes.
Madam
Senator
Chair,
Betzel?
Yeah, I think there could be unintended consequences, and it may severely, I don't know, it may severely limit what the authors are trying to do here, so I think I need to think about that one, but I'm interested in seeing what Senator Marty thinks, too.
Let's have Ms. Pontius finish the amendment, and then we'll get reactions from Senator Marty. Ms. Pontius?
Madam Chair, members, then on page 3, line 17, I think you can delete the paragraph A quoting there, and then delete lines 20 and 21, unless you want to leave that in for comfort language. Is to state, right now it states that they can consent to marriage or adoption, but since it's being narrowed down, I don't think that can just come out.
So, Ms. Pontius, all of subdivision 9 can just come out?
Just leave the paragraph A in, so just take out that quoting there on line 17,
yep,
or the letter, and then take out lines 20 and 21.
Okay. Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, just had a question on the line, page 2, line 34. You were making it so it would be the last clause would be, and the child's health care providers. And you would delete everything from there until the word termination on page 3, line 1.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, I think that does accomplish more of what we've been talking about. We want the authority to deal with these limited things, not, you shouldn't need to say this doesn't authorize them to give the child authority to marry or get adopted, because that wasn't the intent in the first place. And if you just limit it to this, I think it's much clearer.
Any other section, Ms. Pontius?
Yeah, Madam Chair, then on page 3, line 34, delete everything after the first two there. So, and then on line 35, delete everything before enroll. And then finally, on page 6, line 7, delete the first comma and insert end, and then delete everything after providers, delete line 8, and delete line 9 up to the period. That's it.
So Senator Betzel is concerned that this may be counter to what you're trying to do. Do you have any thoughts about that? Or,
Madam Chair, the point of this is not to give the person all kinds of, we're not planning them to be the new parent or guardian. I mean, they may effectively become that, but at this point what we're trying to do is give them something. If they are to become the permanent guardian, they should go through the process to make that happen. But for this is meant more for short term to fill in the gaps, and I think this should accomplish what we're trying to get.
Okay. Any further discussions on Senator Olson's amendment? And I want the record to reflect that we're going to Ms. Pontius has all the information down, and so we're going to give Ms. Pontius a little bit of latitude, Senator Marty, to make sure that all those changes are captured in the record. Any further discussions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I don't know that I could do this or that Ms. Pontius could do this quickly, but based on what Senator Marty has said, I would feel much more comfortable supporting this bill in addition to the where we've narrowed it in terms of scope of authority. When he talked about this being for a shorter term kind of emergency situation, and I'm thinking of my concern about there being kind of no oversight or authorization over what could become a permanent placement decision, even though you say that's not the intent, and I'm sure it's not, the bill would kind of allow that to happen. I would like to see something where there's a reasonable limit to this, whether it's 3 months, 6 months, whatever it might be, and that anything after that would require somebody to sign off on it. You know, somebody that's actually looked at the home situation and determined that it's in the best interest of the child, you know, to continue it. And I can see where there might even be a benefit when we're looking at costs and everything of simplifying a process. But at some point, I think somebody needs to be involved to make sure it is an adequate and healthy living situation for the child, because otherwise we're kind of eliminating, we're really changing the involvement of Health and Human Services in reviewing that placement and making sure that it's adequate and safe for the child.
Mr. Benevitz, as a practitioner, when a circumstance like this arises, and the parents, the grandparents or the caregiver has gone through all the efforts to try to contact or have contact with the parents, and they refuse to come and retain custody, how long does it take generally before the caregivers could get permanent or legal custody or through the traditional judicial process to get custody, legal custody of these kids?
Well, it's going to vary on every case, but at a minimum, it would probably take several months at a minimum. And there would be some, obviously, some legal costs incurred by the caregiver. Even in good situations, it can easily take more than several months. You know, that's just when they, several months from when they start the legal action. I don't know. I understand Senator Olson's concerns. If it were limited to 6 months, even if someone were diligent in trying to get a court order for the legal and physical custody, they may not be able to do it within that time period.
Madam Chair.
Senator Marty.
On that point, and I'm far from an expert in any of this, but I do think we got to recognize the fact that in most of these cases, the parent is the grandparent or whoever's taking care of the kid. Maybe, I mean, they're pulling for their kid to come through, and they're not sure if whatever is wrong, whatever the crisis is, that it, they may have a sense, I think, well, we're going to end up raising this child. And in the past, what they've done is, in some cases, they've gotten authority, and at a certain point after a year or two, I'd picture they would start trying to move that way if they can afford the legal proceedings. And otherwise, they're going to just keep doing it and figuring, well, this is a de facto, we're going to raise the kid until they're 18. And I think we got to recognize the limits, the financial and other, the hassle. A lot of these folks, I mean, what I hear from a lot of the grandparents trying to raise grandkids is they don't have the money or the strength or whatever. And every hassle we put in their way is something. So I'm sensitive with Senator Olson's concern. I would be inclined to think that this 1 year, I mean, first of all, I don't think I'd limit to anything less than a year because of just the sheer hassle of doing it. I thought the way the bill had done it, and I didn't write the bill, but I thought the 1 year and no limits on the fact you could renew it, I think maybe what you might want to do is say that you don't want it to go on 3 or 4 years. I agree with you, what I have some point somebody step in, but I'd be inclined to say more like a year or two rather than a few months.
Senator Marty or Mr. Benevitz, on line 1.18, when you talk about the fact that a relative caretaker of a child who has voluntarily been given custody of the child by a parent or legal custodian, do we need to tighten the idea of a parent a little bit more here? What if you have a child where the parents are divorced and you've got a custodial parent and a non-custodial parent? So what are you contemplating here? Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, that's a good point. And Ms. Pontius, that was the issue I wanted to raise a little bit earlier that I had heard from Ms. Pontius, or I had seen in a memo right when I walked in the room here, not before then. So I apologize for not having more time to think it over or discuss it with Mr. Banovitz. But yeah, you don't want it where a non-custodial parent kidnaps the kid and brings him to grandma and says, you've got custody now. But this clearly wouldn't give them that authority anyway because the other parent can just override it at any time anyway. This gives them no legal authority other than with the voluntary cooperation of the parents. So I'm not sure if you need something there. I think you might. The question more would be, in my mind, is if the non-custodial parent, if one parent has been lost their custody of the child through the courts, and they're coming in and saying, hey, I want to override this, I want to take charge of the kid, I don't think that this would give it to them, but I I think if the courts have turned somebody away from it, I guess that's where the complexity in my mind comes in.
So Grandma and Grandpa has Jane and John. Mom is the legal custodian. Mom leaves them with Grandma and Grandpa, disappears. Grandma and Grandpa can't get a hold of her. But then Dad comes and says, I'm the parent. Even though Mom is the legal custodian and grandparents now have an authorization, Dad still has the ability to override Grandma, Grandpa, even though Dad's not the legal custodian. Mr. Benevitz, is that the intention here?
I think the intention would be that, well, first of all, I guess I'm not exactly clear what you mean by legal custodian. If both parents have legal custody but one parent has physical custody or primary physical custody, I would say that the non-physical custodian parent certainly would have the ability and the opportunity under this to override the relative. Yes.
Okay. I asked the question wrong. That's exactly the answer I was looking for. So you answered it right.
I would say that if a parent has been considered and a court determines that they do not even have legal custody of the child, then I would say that that parent probably does not have the authority or may not have the authority. I don't know, that's a good question, but that would be more of a gray area.
Senator Olson?
And that just leads me to another question, Madam Chair, on line 2.1. It says the relative caregiver is unable to contact the parent. And I think this contemplates the parent, you know, probably the child of the grandparents. But I don't know that it requires both parents being contacted and getting the consent of both parents in this situation. This is just such a potentially, I understand the intent that we're trying to get at, but it's an area of the law that's complicated, that we've got a lot of laws about regarding the interchange of people's rights and the system that we have in place to make this decision regarding kids. And so, you know, maybe the family law bar or somebody. I guess I just feel like I need to hear from somebody who's really thought all through the ramifications of how this would all interplay with what we have in place in our law right now.
Members, any more discussion on the bill?
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, it's just grammatical. You see, if it goes on long enough, then we all read. And so it's on page 6. Line 31, just you need to insert the word in after the word acting. I just got to reading and I stumped.
Where is it?
Pretty soon Senator Higgins will be reading. And then
so members, I think that there are a number of questions that have been raised with respect to some of the gray areas. And I don't know that we have the time in the committee tonight to resolve those areas, Senator Marty. I mean, we've already given a substantial amount of time to kind of revise and work the bill over in the committee. So it's, you know, it's your call, and I guess we could let the members have a conversation about that. Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, what I think I will suggest, I think, like with Senator Olson's point, I mean, I agree with you, the complexity of it and so on, and contact. I think the intent was either parent, but what if one is not even a legal custodian? And I think that your point about saying you'd like to hear from the family law section of the bar, I think that kind of thing is appropriate. Maybe what we would make sense, and I would love to see us be able to move this bill yet this year, but if we would lay the bill over for right now, we would try and ask for set up a meeting with perhaps if one or two of you are interested as well with Mr. Banovitz and the family law section, just try to have some people go over this to make sure that we iron out some of those issues, because I think you've tightened it up in the way we want it tightened up, because we do not want this to be a big open-ended thing, but I sense your discomfort, and I think it's understandable discomfort, so maybe we could lay the bill over and try and get some resolution on some of those issues and then bring it back to you if there's a chance yet this year. And I realize the difficulties of that.
Okay. All right, Senator Marty, then we're just going to lay the bill over.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We will set up a meeting, and we would be glad to talk with both of you two who have indicated that. Yes. Thank you very much for your time.
Bite some dust.
Senator Higgins?
Hey. Oh, Senator Higgins.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, to start with, I'd like to offer the A1 delete everything amendment.
Senator Higgins offers the A1 amendment to put the bill into the shape she would like it to be in. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Senate File 436 modifies the Uniform Parentage Act to address the medical advancements that have been made current paternity and maternity laws out of date. You will see in your packet letters of support.
It's not the amendment.
And I believe there's another letter being passed out from Resolve as well. So you should have four letters of support for this. And I'm going to turn it over to Steve Snyder, who will go through the details of the bill with you.
Mr. Snyder, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, thank you for having me here. I am Steve Snyder, S-N-Y-D-E-R, and I am the chair-elect of the Minnesota State Bar Association Family Law Section. I appear both on my individual behalf as the initial motivator of this bill and on behalf of the Family Law Section to express its support. The purpose of the bill is to try to get the law and medical technology in sync when it comes to establishing who the legal parents are of the children who are resulting from these procedures. The biggest change that has occurred since these medical procedures have taken over is that the genetic and birth presumptions of the existing paternity statute do not contemplate a category called intended parents. There are very often parents who are the intended legal parents of the offspring of assisted reproduction who do not have either a birth or a genetic relationship. We are adding a presumption to the paternity-maternity statute to give them equal standing with all of the other existing presumptions, both birth and genetics, not so that they have an unfair advantage over the birth mothers or genetic parents, but so that they have equal standing, so that a court asked to decide a contested matter of paternity can at least consider the intended parent's standing, rights, and the best interests of the child in awarding that. That is the primary change. Circulating around that change are several other changes. First of all, making express what is already implicit in the statute, and that is that our existing statute is intended to address both paternity and maternity, even though all of the references in the statute refer to paternity and use male pronouns. It also indicates that in a contested case between a birth mother and intended parents, the normal statutory presumption that a birth mother has uncontested right to both sole legal and physical custody would not apply in those circumstances, and that the court could vary that based on the best interests of the child on a temporary basis, pending a final resolution of the parentage issues. And finally, which I think is a key cornerstone of this bill, it enhances judicial efficiency. Currently, scores of lengthy hearings are necessary to establish parentage. In the 99.5% of these cases that are not contested, this bill will allow the courts to enter pre-birth ex parte orders so that we're not taking up unnecessary judicial time in a time of budget cutbacks and understaffing. I believe that the support of the infertility community through Resolve, of all of the relevant legal associations and organizations that have an interest in this indicate the efficacy of this bill and militate in favor of its passage. Thank you.
Questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I support the concept here just like I supported Senator Higgins' bill last year, and I really like that bill. I see you're kind of in a scaled back version in terms of, you know, just kind of much less detail or prescriptive or whatever than the bill was last year. But I just wonder about this. It seems like you've tried to address this situation by fitting the language into existing language about mothers and fathers, and instead of treating them, you know, in this kind of situation, mothers and fathers who are not the biological parents are kind of in the same boat. And so what this says to me is that if you are a contractual father or whatever father you call your, you know, I don't know how you refer to that father, then you have a presumption in your favor, or at least a presumption that's on an equal standing with these other presumptions. But if you're the mother in that same situation, the way this is written, I don't see anything that gives her any standing. I just see something that the biological mother doesn't have the right to custody. But I don't see anything, I mean, not necessarily, it says in this kind of situation. So just in terms of how this is structured, wouldn't it make sense to have a separate area for the mother and father, the non-biological mother and father, and address it that way? Because otherwise it seems to me like you're sort of mixing apples and oranges here a little bit. And you're giving rights to the father that you're not giving to the mother, and you're not really giving her any standing.
Madam Chair?
Mrs. Snyder, I'll let you answer the question, but I think what I'd like to do is you can answer the question. I'd like to move on to the rest of the testifiers, and then we can come back and have a discussion, members, on the bill.
Okay.
Mr. Snyder?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Olson, that exact issue is the root of the additional modification that expressly says that all of the procedures and presumptions in the statutory chapter apply to both maternity and paternity. So that's the initial change in subdivision 2 of 257.54, which says, provisions of this section relating to determination of paternity, including all presumptions and procedures, apply to determinations of maternity. So it applies it equally to both men and women. The difficulty was that the chapter as written in 1982 never contemplated that we would be able to split the genetics and birth and intent for mothers. So it only referred to paternity, and rather than wholesale go throughout the bill and change all of those complicated interwoven references, the expansion of the application to both paternity and maternity means that all of those paternity references and male pronouns also apply to mothers.
Okay.
Senator Higgins, your next testifier. You have testifiers?
Chair, my next testifier is Diana DePoister from Resolve.
Ms. DePoister, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having me. I'm the advocacy chair for the advocacy committee of the Midwest Region of Resolve. We help people who are experiencing infertility all the way through adoption and living without parenting. And this bill, we feel we stand in very strong support because it helps to streamline all the issues around parentage and make it simpler for the parents as they become parents. And that's such a miraculous and joyful experience. We just want to make sure that it stays that way without clogging up the paperwork and the judicial system. So we fully support this bill. Thank you.
And Mr. Brian Lake. Then we have two other testifiers. I believe these individuals are going to speak in opposition to the bill, Mrs. Tom Pritchard and Mr. Greg Troy. Please come up to the table. Mr. Pritchard, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Tom Pritchard, President of the Minnesota Family Council, and we oppose this bill. Looking at this bill, it's really a simple bill as far as surrogacy bill goes, but I think the implications are extremely far-reaching. In fact, I would argue it goes much farther than the surrogacy bill you addressed or considered in 2008, Senate File 2965. We oppose that bill for a number of reasons, and this one, which we believe goes way beyond that one. This bill allows individuals to enter into agreements which would now be legally enforceable for purposes of paternity, maternity, and also custody, and also for the transferring of babies from a birth mother to other individuals. Previous surrogacy bills limited such transactions, or at least were proposed in the legislature, to infertile couples, married couples. None of that is here. They had requirements that intended parents provide, go through reviews and studies, background checks. None of that is in this bill. This bill basically throws the door wide open to surrogacy, which is, in essence, in our view, baby selling. As Harvard business professor Deborah Spahr said when addressing the subjects, is we are selling children. It's really the new eugenics in this respect. It has the potential to make Minnesota a magnet for these sorts of practices. And at its core, this is, we believe, the commodification of children. It's baby selling, pure and simple. It's baby selling because a birth mother contracts with a third body to turn over the baby she gives birth to another person for cash. And so that's a core concern. Other concerns, there's really no consideration of the best interest of the child at all in this bill. If you look at Section 4, there's no one looking out for the best interest of the children. This bill treats these agreements as simply private agreements between adults. And there's no consideration of the interest of the child. It allows the couples or the individuals contracting to circumvent guardian ad litems, background checks, all these other things. Children are cut out of the process totally. We are also concerned that this opens the door to designer babies, which is really the new eugenics. We see this happening on the Internet, where advertisements for female eggs. One ad said, quote, smart, healthy, beautiful donors from a donor base of 100-plus available egg donors, including professional models. We're creating the new eugenics, and we just think that's a direction we do not want to be encouraging, which we believe this bill will do. We also believe this bill will facilitate more abortions. The destruction of embryos through what's euphemistically called embryo reduction will only increase as you encourage this practice. This practice, frankly, is discouraged in most states and specifically banned in many European countries. Yet Minnesota, under this bill, will be, we believe, aggressively moving in the other direction. We believe this opens the door and will facilitate the exploitation of women. This will invariably target low-income women with compensation for reproductive purposes. Analogous is the whole area of prostitution, which is the exploitation of women for sexual purposes. Obviously different, but I think there's an analogy there. There's no requirement that the parents be fit. And ultimately, this bill undermines the adoption process. As you can see in Section 4, it just totally circumvents the adoption process and cuts children and the safeguards for children out of the process. So for those reasons, we oppose this bill.
Thank you. Mr. Troy?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the Judiciary Committee, Senator Higgins. My name is Greg Troy. I'm a practicing attorney, father of 8 children, adoptive father as well, and I practice somewhat in the area of adoption, and I'm here in opposition to Senate file. Unfortunately, this is the third time I've testified in some form or fashion against a similar bill, and I believe that I'm going to limit my remarks to two areas. One, the fiscal impact that this bill is going to have, and the second, the dramatic change in the public policy that I believe this legislation is pursuing. I find it curious that despite the fact that Governor Plenty has vetoed this in the past, we still don't have the Department of Human Services issuing a fiscal note on this, and it's dramatic. It will be dramatic. Because there's no fiscal note, we have Mr. Schneider here representing that somehow it's going to save costs. I think it's going to do dramatically otherwise. And not just to the courts, by the way, but I think to the Department of Human Services, because when we talk about adoption, Minnesota is going to change with this statute its preference for surrogate intended children. That is to say, the process will be easier than it is currently for adoptive families. And as a result, the static number of children that are unintended and unwanted that end up being placed through the county and into hopefully foster care and then adoptive homes will not have the same attention from prospective infertile couples. And I think that is a fiscal note that the Department of Human Services should be addressing, and I think it's irresponsible that they are not looking at what impact this will have. The public policy change is going to be dramatic, and the reason is because we've now bypassed with some changes to who the presumptive parents are, the whole policy that has been set up throughout the 80s and 90s with respect to how do we defend the best interests of children. And this bill doesn't allow for anything as simple as a home study. It, in fact, says there won't be a requirement for a home study. It similarly doesn't put the same burdens on adoptive agencies who are now required by statute to be nonprofits. And they've subjected them. Department of Human Services annually looks into the finances of adoption agencies, requires them to have CPA audits, requires Department of Human Services to come in and review their policies and practices. There won't be any comparable review of the in vitro fertilization clinics. And as a result, what's going to happen is the intended couples that would otherwise be available to adopt children will now turn to the lesser invasive policies that are being put forth for a couple that would otherwise have to go through the policies of an adoption agency. And most importantly, I think for the welfare of children, it's going to be the failure to require a home study. No background checks, no post-placement reports to a court on how the children are doing with the intended parents. And as a result, people will look at this and they'll talk to attorneys like myself and say, well, why not go after in vitro? Furthermore, the next step that this lobby will go after is to change what is covered by insurance. And that is going to be a dramatic increase to the cost of insurance in Minnesota, to the point where I think there's a bill in Illinois that wanted to expand this in vitro treatment to include infertile couples and to change the definition of infertile couples to be anything. Could be postmenopausal
Mr.
women
Troy,
that want to be granted.
Mr. Troy, I'm sorry to cut you off, but we don't have that bill before Minnesota, before the Senate and before the committee today. And so let's just talk about the bill that's before us today.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. So I think there's going to be a dramatic shift in the public policy is my overriding theme. To the degree that we've got, I think, home studies not required of adoptive required of adoptive couples, but not of intended parents. we've bypassed what has been put into place in public policy in Minnesota, and that is the best interest of the child. There is no best interest of the child required here. There's nobody regulating that because the Department of Human Services is not involved in this process. So what we're left with is, I think, the Department of Commerce is now going to regulate in vitro clinics and the contracts that are being entered into, and courts are going to see an increase in the disputes between intended parents and those who were raising a child through the 9 months of pregnancy and the various disputes that can arise through contracts. And that's where the courts are going to get burdened, is with the possibility of claims under contract. And those claims under contract are already in the courts. They're just not between parties, intended parents and birth moms who believe that they were misrepresented when they signed these contracts. and don't believe that they're required to go through selective reductions of implanted fetuses, that they find that offensive, or they didn't realize that the parent that they were going to be placing with was going to be parenting out of state or whatever the requirements were, you've got contract problems that are going to arise. And as it relates to the simplification argument, in Hennepin County, the courts have already signed an order that allows you to go through and bypass the separate hearing that Mr. Schneider is talking about. The judges have already started this, and I think it would be worth the legislature determining whether or not there really is an increase in the cost relative to these contracts. I think Hennepin County is our experimental county, and back in the early 90s, when we did lawyer legislation through the judges, we had this body came back and proposed Minnesota Statute 259.471 to talk about these pre-adoptive custody orders that this bill is asking for.
So I think Mr. Troy, I'm giving you the courtesy of giving you a chance to finish your presentation. I just feel like you're wandering a little bit far afield from the bill. So,
I think this bill, Madam Chair, could be improved upon if we took the current structure that's in place for adoptions. It's found under 259.47. You've got pre-adoptive custody orders. The judges sign them ex parte, just like Mr. Schneider is advocating, except there's a requirement that health insurance be in place. There's a requirement that a home study be done. There's requirements that the court approve the costs being paid to birth moms before those payments are approved. There's a number of structures that are being bypassed here, and you've set up a preferential system for surrogacy over adoption, and I think that fiscal note is glaringly absent. And with that, I take questions.
Thank you. Senator Olson.
Well, Madam Chair, I don't know where to start in terms of responding to some of what I've heard here. Because, first of all, the comment about Minnesota is going to become a magnet for something because we're regulating a practice that's going on all over the country seems to me that putting regulation in place might push people where it's not regulated, which is a lot of other places. I didn't hear you say that this is illegal anywhere, so it's happening all over the country. And the fact that we're regulating this seems to me to be the right thing to do if there are some concerns about, you know, bringing some structure to the system.
Senator Olson, we're not regulating anything in this bill.
Well,
so
okay.
Can we limit the conversation to the bill that's before us? I understand that Mr. Troy and Mr. Pritchard are concerned from their perspective about some of the implications. But let's just, as members of the committee, I'm not as interested in us responding directly to the concerns expressed by Mr. Troy and Mr. Pritchard. I'd like to focus on processing the bill. So can we come back? If members, you have concerns or questions about the specific aspects of the bill, let's have that conversation with Senator Higgins. We're kind of running short on time, and we have one more bill to process yet. So,
Madam Chair?
Senator Betzel.
I have a question about the bill, and it's the effective date. It has an immediate effective date, which usually works well for state agencies because they, you know, they can follow what's going on here. It's a little hard for the courts and everybody else to know when a law goes into effect when even we don't know when it goes into effect. I mean, it passes here, it goes into effect when the governor signs it. So I just don't understand why it couldn't be the August 1st effective date and apply to proceedings pending on or commenced after that date.
Mr. Snyder.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, thank you very much. The intention of the effective date is to make certain that for agreements that were entered into consensually among all parties prior to the hopeful passage of this legislation, that those parents would also have the benefit of the expedited parentage determinations that are afforded under the statute.
But
Senator Betzel?
Madam Chair, Mr. Snyder, you may be tracking this bill and know well about it, But once the governor signs it and it goes into becomes law, how is anybody else going to know about it? Because it takes some time to get the word out and let people know. People just aren't going to know that we have a new law in the books that have changed, you know, some of these proceedings. So how will they know?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Schneider.
Senator Betzel, the process for establishing parentage will be still be governed by court procedures, so they will have to file petitions for parentage and apply to judicial officers. The judicial officers are intimately aware of what's going on in the legislature and the various laws that affect their orders, so that people that are approaching them will be advised by the court system as to the procedures that are available for them.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Usually the judges go to a conference sometime around June to be told about what's happening. I recognize in this world of emails and so forth they can be told about it, but again, you're going to know about it. I just don't know the rest of the public or even some judges are going to know about it until I just don't know why immediate effective date is necessary for this bill. So,
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, it's Senator Betzel. The amendable to change and get to August 1st.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'll move that the bill be changed to August 1st and apply to proceedings pending or commenced on or after that date.
For the record, Ms. Pontius, could you read Senator Betzel's motion?
Madam Chair, members, on page 3, line 19 of the A1 amendment, delete the day following final enactment and insert August 1, 2010.
So moved.
On Senator Betzel's motion, any further discussions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed say nay.
No.
Motion prevails. Any further discussions on Senate File 436?
As amended. Madam Chair.
As amended.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lemmer.
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, in the last bill that we had a year, maybe 2 years ago, the governor vetoed that bill. If I remember correctly, one of the elements of that veto message was that there was no reference to the interests of the child in the event that there would be a dispute between parties. And has that been attempted to be addressed in this particular version?
Mr. Schneider?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer. The paternity-maternity determinations that are made by the courts, which will apply to all of these proceedings, under the existing paternity-maternity statute, multiple presumptions can coexist at the same time, and each has the same or as little legal effect as another. So a man who's married to a birth mother has a presumption. If a man can prove he's a genetic father, he has a presumption. Both presumptions are given effect under the law. We're adding another one for intended parents under certain circumstances. Those presumptions do not trump one another unless and until a judge in a court proceeding determines which presumption to give legal effect and which one to void. The statute requires the judge in that case to make its determination primarily based on the best interests of the children. So I beg to differ with Mr. Pritchard and Mr. Troy. It does subject all of these to a determination based expressly on the best interests of the child, in addition to public policy and the weight of reason. So that is a standard specifically incorporated in the rest of the statute to which this applies.
And it's not in this bill, Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, because it's already existing in other pieces of statute.
All right, Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins, can you pull on the microphone closer? Because we have to get this recorded for the record. Senator Limmer, let me ask a follow-up on your line of questioning. So, Mr. Schneider, what your the language on line 3.8 to 3.17, which allows a pre-birth order of judgment, in that process, the best interest of the child is
contemplated because a judge will be giving this. It's just at what time table, pre-birth or after birth, but this is pre-birth, but the best interest of the child standard is contemplated before a judge would give this order. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, yes, that is correct.
Senator Limmer?
Madam Chair, I know that in a variety of areas of law, we don't always treat the preborn child with the same degree of protection or best interest in a variety of public policies. And you can go to one extreme, such as abortion. You can go to another example of the intention of a woman birthing a child, but let's say is attacked by an attacker, and if that child would be harmed or killed, a criminal charge could be applied to the damage done to the unborn child, purely based on the intent of the mother. And we also have other laws that will recognize as the child grows and gets closer to birth, some protections offered to those who are outside of the womb become stronger. And that's a fact. And so I'm trying to determine, where in that spectrum do we recognize the interests of the child? And if it's kind of a sliding scale to be recognized only by a judge, then I'm wondering why we even write a statute about it if a judge is going to determine it. So I'm trying to get a clarification on this particular piece of legislation, where on that line of protection does the best interest of the child fall. And I think I've been given, maybe I heard it wrong, but we're simply going to pass that on to a court to decide. Is that how I'm reading it or interpreting your comments?
Madam Chair?
Mrs. Schneider?
Thank you, Senator Limmer. Best interests of the child is a broad reference which comes into play in many different legal arenas. In a dissolution, it is the contest between the two legal parents who are divorcing as to who should have custody and control. In an abortion situation, it's the mother's right versus the child's right, and that's been established by precedent that has nothing to do with this bill. The best interests of the child standard that is applied here is the same one that's been applied in determining who the legal parents of a particular child should be for more than 30 years under the 1982 paternity-maternity statute. So it's simply the court's determination in the best interests of the child which of the petitioning adults would be the best parent for reasons of the child's best interests and the public policy of the state. So it's limited only to that and doesn't get into the penumbra of the other areas about which you're referring, I believe.
Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So basically, in a nutshell, would it be a fair interpretation of this that if an agreement has been made, whether it's in vitro fertilization or whatever type of process that's happening today, that and no one has a dispute or a disagreement with where the child should go, then that agreement that's made between all the parties basically will be given the opportunity to kind of have its stamp of approval given by the court. But if there is a disagreement by the parties about who the parent of the child should be, then this puts it to the court to determine whether the child should go based on the best interest of the child standard. Is that kind of what this does?
Madam Chair?
Mr. Schneider?
Senator Olson, that is a fair interpretation, and I would even extend it to the fact that the judge will not be able to put a stamp of approval on a pre-arranged or a consent agreement without also considering that same standard. The requirements are that a verified petition be submitted to the judge, and that petition in practice has to allege facts that gives the court the factual foundation to find that it is in the best interest of the child, that it is awarding the child to the correct and best parents.
All right, any further discussions? Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As we've had this discussion, it'd be interesting to know, at least to put on record, because someone's going to listen to this conversation somewhere down the road, if a surrogate mother was in contract to birth a child, let's say she's not in any way a biological mother to the child, and she decides somewhere in the path that she does not want to go forward. Does the contract trump what you call her right to an abortion, or does this referred right to an abortion trump the contract?
Senator Limmer, though, I mean, that's not what's contemplated in this bill. We're not talking about
I understand
about
that, but since we've gone down this road, do we know that? Or would Mr. Schneider, you're the expert in this much more than anyone here, and I'm just wondering, in your history, has that ever come up?
Well, let the record reflect that that's not what this bill is about.
I understand.
So you may answer the question to entertain Senator Limmer's curiosity.
Madam Chair, thank you. I agree that this bill does not even touch tangentially on that issue, but I understand that it's an important question that is relevant to my elected senator, so I will choose to respond to that question. Senator Limmer, the contract exists or does not exist under Minnesota law, depending on the interpretation of the courts. This statute will not affect any of that. And whether and how those contractual rights interplay with Roe v. Wade and its progeny has not been determined. There has never been a case litigated anywhere in the United States to date that establishes whether anybody can contractually waive that right. So at this time, I believe that whatever the constitutional parameters are of that right, those are what exist and govern. But again, that has nothing to do with what we're doing in this bill.
Okay. Thanks.
Any further discussions? Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair, I'll move that Senate file 436 be recommended to pass. I believe it just goes to the floor.
As amended.
There being no further discussions, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
Nay.
Motion prevails.
Thank you all very much.
I'm not one short bill.
Remember, the last bill on the agenda is Senate File 2736. Senator Scheid certainly can speak for herself, but as she's coming to the table, Senator Scheid has asked us to take up this bill a little bit earlier, as early as possible, because she certainly is wanting to put the issue before members of the committee, as well as to take input from the public. And so I believe this is the executive branch's proposal, the governor's proposal, and Mr. Harry Kennedy is here to help us walk through this extremely long and complex bill, which is all of like one number that's being changed. But it does have some implications. And so Senator Scheid has asked that the committee take some time to have a conversation about it. And then she would like it to be laid on the table and then to be brought back for a conversation, Senator Scheid?
Madam Chair, yes. That's
okay. No author's amendments?
I believe there will not be an author's amendment today.
You believe there will not be?
There will not be an author's amendment today.
Okay. Madam Chair, it looks so simple, and obviously it has many implications. And it has cost implications. It has, which we can discuss, we will discuss. And it has policy implications, obviously. It's a very serious subject. And I think that it represents where where we are, obviously not everyone will agree, but I think that the people I represent have deep concern about sex offenders and people who commit sexual crimes. This affects only criminal sexual conduct in the first degree. And I don't know if you have this statute, but in front of you, I probably should have done all that, but I mean, I know we have it available. And Mr. Kennedy can discuss, I think you'll probably explain just who that is, who those people
sure.
are. So one of the motivations is that there needs to be increased punishment, one, for these heinous crimes, and the other position that is a concern of mine is that it may slow the pipeline, into the sex offender treatment program. At some point, obviously, that kicks in, but I think a lot of us are very skeptical about the efficacy of the treatment, and I'm not criticizing those who provide it. I haven't been talking enough, I guess. So, and Senator Betzold would probably disagree with that, but anyway.
Well, Senator Shine, Mr. Kennedy has been waiting very patiently all night for us. So we'll give your throat a rest, and we'll put Mr. Kennedy in the hot seat. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Senate File 2736 seeks to double the presumptive sentence for criminal sexual conduct first degree. CSC 1 offenses are the most serious sex offenses. The current presumptive sentence for CSC 1 is 144 months. That represents a sentence of 12 years, only 8 of which is served in a DOC facility. This bill would change the presumptive sentence to 300 months, and that represents a 25-year sentence. 16.6 years of that would be served in a DOC facility. The physical and mental scars of such offenses are long-lasting, especially when the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission estimates that 85% of all sex offenses, the victims are minors, and 34% of those are under 13. When an adult forces his body into that of a 5-year-old, I submit that 8 years spent in a DOC facility is not enough. This bill recommends enhanced sentencing that appropriately addresses the serious nature of and damage caused by CSC 1 offenses. And with that, open to discussion.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Kennedy or Senator Scheid? Mr. Kennedy, I wonder if the scenario that you describe is very heinous. But are we picking up other people who are in the first degree that may be at the lower end? Because this just deals with only first degree. And I'm wondering if, and our intention is to really go after the heinous individuals who have committed that. Are we missing an opportunity by focusing just on the first degree without thinking about some of the other degrees where there might be similar levels of heinousness or seriousness? And then are we capturing some individuals in the first degree that may not necessarily be appropriate in terms of the level of seriousness? Did that make any sense? I guess I just...
It does. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. CSE 1, there's a few different elements to it. Obviously, CSE 1 represents the sexual penetration cases. CSE 2 represents sexual contact offenses, which could be contact with private parts of another a person through the clothing, not through the clothing. Quite frankly, CSC 1 does include sexual contact with a person under 13 years of age, the more serious offense as defined in subdivision 11 of 609341. So there is one at least serious, very serious contact offense case here, a situation in addition to the penetration cases or penetration instances. These cases, these crimes, one of the elements are victims under the age of 13. Also, if a victim is between ages 13 and 16 and a person is 4 years older and in a position of authority over that person, that would also fall into a CSE-1 situation. Also, instances where great bodily harm, weapons are used, injury to the complainant. So these are your most serious cases. Now, to answer your question, Madam Chair, about perhaps would it be advisable to look at increases to CSC 2, I think that's something everyone would be open to. Because right now, the presumptive sentence for a CSC 2 is 90 months. And if we're going to increase the CSC 1 offenses to 300 months, I think it would be advisable to look at CSC 2 offenses if
That was the initial question that I had when I first looked at it, just capturing the first degrees. Why don't we had a couple of other people members who would like to testify, and I thought it would be interesting. I mean, because this is a conversation. I mean, a discussion on the bill, and since we have Mr. Kennedy here, I'd like to have the other testifiers come up and speak, and then I'd like Mr. Kennedy back at the table, or you can stay there if you would like, and then we can have a discussion about. Other questions in the bill. Ms. Donna Dunn.
Good afternoon, Chair Moore and members of the committee. My name is Donna Dunn, and I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. MNCASA provides education, training, and advocacy for Minnesota sexual violence services programs across the state and represents over 70 member programs throughout the state as a voice for victims and survivors of sexual violence, the programs that serve them, and concerned citizens committed to ending sexual violence in Minnesota. I'm here today not to offer a position on the bill that is before you, but to rather express our interest in supporting a comprehensive response to sexual violence in Minnesota. We are pleased that the governor and the administration are interested in stopping sexual violence. In addition to this bill, the administration assisted us in presenting in December in Minnesota the Minnesota Summit to Prevent Sexual Violence, to which five state departments committed staff and or financial support. This was the first of its kind event and gathering in the country, and the support of the administration is a commitment and assistance that we value. Well, briefly to define the problem that we're talking about, according to the Minnesota Department of Health's 2007 Cost of Sexual Violence report, we have an annual incidence of sexual assault in Minnesota that affects 61,000 people in our state. The economic impact is estimated to be $8 billion annually, which comes to about $1,500 per resident. At these rates, we are talking about a problem in our communities that is so common that most incidents go unnoticed in the daily news. It is a problem that has become such a routine part of our culture that state epidemiologists describe it as endemic, meaning these incidence rates reflect a health and safety problem that is not that of an emerging epidemic, but rather they have become a norm. Well, changing the norm of sexual violence requires a multidimensional approach that encompasses primary prevention efforts, services, supports for victims and survivors, accessible and a fully functioning law enforcement and justice system, and a system for incarceration, treatment, and reform of offenders. In other words, we believe that being tough on sexual violence, which is everybody's interest, requires a variety of interrelated responses. It does take a prison cell, and it takes a whole lot more. The 2007 Costs of Sexual Violence Report also looked at how the state has chosen to allocate its resources in response to sexual violence. In fiscal year 2006, we spent roughly 45% more on housing and treatment for convicted offenders than we did on medical care, support services, law enforcement, and access to the justice system for victims and survivors. I don't have the information to update those 2006 figures, but I assume the gap between what we spend on offenders and on victims has at least stayed the same or most likely increased. And I know we still put no state resources into the primary prevention of sexual violence. I want to emphasize that, and I will say it again. We spend $0 on primary prevention. Activities, those would be, that reduce the risk factors associated with sexual violence, strengthen the protective factors that reduce the likelihood of sexual violence, and here's what's most important, change the environment that supports and normalizes violence that uses sex. And that's what concerns me today about the conversation we're having in Minnesota about toughening our response to sexual violence. We do need to act in the interest of public safety. And at the same time, we also need to take a step back, survey the problem of sexual violence as a whole, and think carefully about how and what we are doing in our daily roles to find a comprehensive solution. By way of example, when steps were taken in 2005 to revise Minnesota's sentencing guideline for sex offenders, the 36-month presumptive executed sentencing for repeat offenders was repealed. It wasn't repealed because it was a bad law. It was repealed through a drafting error. But our efforts to restore this 36-month presumptive executed sentencing for repeat offenders has been turned back year after year because it will add a relatively minor cost to our correction system, dollars that were never removed from the correction system budget when the law was initially repealed. But with the passage of time, these costs are considered to be new costs today. Well, additionally, MnCASA and others have been calling for legislation to enhance the penalty for those who are repeatedly convicted for sex offenses that are charged as gross misdemeanors. Again, that cost is relatively low, but the impact could be significant in intervening with lower-level offenders. Here's another area in which we could look at the data, study the effectiveness of the response. However, so far, the cost has been deemed to be too great for our corrections system budget to bear. We fully appreciate the seriousness of the state's financial situation. It, too, seems to be an endemic problem. Recognizing this state of affairs, MnCASA has chosen to focus on a variety of low-cost or no-cost approaches that will support our efforts to toughen Minnesota's response to sexual violence. By way of example, we've distributed a copy of our 2010 legislative agenda. This was developed by MnCASA Member Programs, our public policy committee, and has been endorsed by our board of directors. Let me tell you a little bit about it. In addition, and this would be in addition to increasing the oversight of an ability to intervene earlier with offenders at all levels, meaning the 36-month presumptive commitment reinstated, MnCASA is proposing policy reforms that address primary prevention by clarifying the state sexual health education standards to include sexual violence prevention, and creating a preference for pornography-free environments in state purchasing for in-state meetings and travel. These are two reforms that could have long-term impact, could help change the social norms that support sexual violence, and by the way, would add no cost to the state's budget now or in the future. At the same time that we're having discussions about responses to sexual violence that would add significant long-term burdens, financial burdens to the state's budget, we are here in our third year of conversations that could result in reducing crucial advocacy and support services that help victims recover from the trauma of sexual assault. Services that are still not available in all of Minnesota's counties or on all of the state's reservations. We are again talking about actions that could reduce counties' abilities to absorb the cost of emergency health interventions and evidence collection, reduce the health care support that victims need for long-term recovery, reduce local law enforcement responses and resources for prosecution, and reduce the justice system's ability to act. As I said earlier, we don't have a position on this particular proposal before the committee today or the other initiatives that respond to sexual violence that are capturing the bulk of the decision makers' attention and the media's attention. However, we do want to draw attention to a few quick facts. First, don't forget that 61,000 Minnesotans are affected by sexual violence each year. Most of these people are unknown to the system. Sexual assault remains an underreported crime, and hence most sex offenders go undetected in our communities. We need to ensure that we're embracing a wide-range strategy and using our limited state dollars in a way that is going to get at the bulk of the problem. And second, commitments that we make today will either open or limit our options to toughen our response to sexual violence in the future. We can invest in a variety of policy and criminal statute reforms that can have a long-term impact, or we can invest all of our resources in a few strategies that deal with the worst of the worst, but limit our ability to move forward on a multifaceted strategy to reduce the reality of sexual violence in Minnesota. We suggest a balanced approach to these two options. MnCASA hopes this committee will give serious considerations to some of the criminal statute reforms that will allow us to intervene with lower-level offenders as part of a broader strategy to prevent future more serious sex crimes offenses. We're prepared to work with you on amendments to address some of these reforms or to help advance previously introduced legislation that has been referred to this committee. We also encourage members of this committee to consider the impact of decisions that are made outside of this committee in other aspects of your legislative work that also have an impact on reducing sexual violence. In closing, I will simply state again, stopping sexual violence is not easy. Yes, it requires prison beds and also much, much more. We should be looking at policies and criminal statute reforms that do not ultimately close the options to investing in long-term impact that we can afford. We should take a holistic approach that will ensure victims will get the support, law enforcement will be available, prosecutors and courts will be accessible, and we must be committed to measures that will ensure that our state begins to invest in preventing sexual violence from happening in the first place. Thank you very much for your attention to this issue and for the hard work that you all do.
Thank you. Mrs. Stewart?
Madam Chair, may I respond, Madam Chair?
Well, Mr. Kennedy, I have to say that I really wasn't quite expecting the testimony that was delivered today. I was hoping that the input would be on the bill, and I gave Ms. Dunn the courtesy of letting her finish. But I have to tell you that I was quite abrupt with Mr. Troy, and you know, you made the time to be here, and I gave you the courtesy of finishing that. I'd like to keep the conversation on the bill, Mr. Kennedy.
Well, that's what I would like to, too.
Yes, and I would invite you all to give your input to Mr. Kennedy or Senator Scheid.
Thank you.
But I really was looking for some input to Senator Scheid, and perhaps it was helpful in the larger context.
And, Madam Chair, if I just might say, I share the concerns that were expressed. The bill obviously doesn't take on all of that, and it's a piece, and I think a very important piece,
of course,
the conversation, but
of course. Thank you, Ms. Dunn. Mr.
Chair, thank you for the courtesy. I appreciate
Madam
it.
Chair.
Senator Foley?
Just brief, is it possible, Ms. Dunn, to get a copy of your notes?
Madam Chair, yes, I would be happy to give you a copy of my notes.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Mr. Kennedy?
I just wanted to make a brief statement before Mr. Stewart came out just to address some of the issues because it is related to the bill. And I appreciate your effort to focus on the bill and why we're here for these dangerous sex offenders. First, there was, as part of the announcement for this bill, comprehensive education piece put out called Net Smarts. It's being delivered to every school. So in terms of prevention and education, there was a comprehensive package that is now going to be delivered to schools so students can learn about the dangers online, issues such as sexting, and things like that. Secondly, we have to be tough on sexual violence. As Donna said, there are a lot of undetected crimes or unreported crimes. That's why when we do convict somebody, they probably have a lot of other victims, and we need to sentence them appropriately, and 8 years is not enough under the presumptive sentence that we currently have right now. We have to be tough on these offenders because these crimes are egregious and the impact is tremendous on the victims.
All right. Mr. Stewart.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is John Stewart. I'm the Minnesota State Public Defender. Been interested in sentencing policy in this area for a long time. In the 1980s, I wrote a book about the sentencing guidelines. I wrote an article about how the guidelines deals with sex offenses. And in 2005, I served on the Governor's Commission on Sex Offenders. And I must say, at that time, we had almost all-day long monthly meetings for quite a while, and we heard experts from around the United States before a proposal was introduced here that subsequently became law. And that brings me to some concerns I have about this particular bill. First of all, this bill doesn't seem to be based on any study. I don't see where the evidence-based practices are that led to the idea that we should respond to sexual violence, particularly by picking one crime and doubling the prison sentence. It's not something that has been, to my knowledge, through the process at the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and there wasn't a task force that talked about how this is the one thing we should do. I'm concerned from a perspective of a person who's worked with the sentencing guidelines now for 30 years in various ways, that to double the sentence for criminal sexual conduct in the first degree creates proportionality problems. One of the claims that was made for the guidelines is that it enabled Minnesota to have a structured relationship between the sentences for different crimes that would be proportional to the harm that's caused to the public. And I would say here, I want to just mention three of these problems. One of them is this. As has been already mentioned, this bill would create a huge gap between the sentences for criminal sexual conduct in the first degree and the second degree. In my practice, I've seen quite a number of close cases of whether there was penetration or not. Was it first degree or second degree? Sometimes when these incidents happen, people have been using chemicals, and it's nighttime, and there's a lot of emotion and confusion, and it's not quite clear whether it's a first-degree or a second-degree case. And this bill would make a difference of almost 20 years in the sentence between the two crimes. It would also make a big difference in the sentence between first degree and the other sexual penetration crime, which is third degree. And I want to say something in a little more detail about that. One of the provisions for criminal sexual conduct in the first degree is injury to the victim. There have been several Supreme Court cases that say that the pain of forcible penetration is enough to be an injury to the victim. So we're not talking about somebody who is forcibly penetrated and also gets a broken arm. We're talking about the injury being the penetration itself. Criminal sexual conduct in the third degree is forcible penetration. So you can see that there's a big gray area between first and third degree in the kind of conduct that is charged out by the 87 separate elected county attorneys in their separate counties. Some people would charge an incident as first, some would charge it as third. Sometimes there's difference between first and second that's very close. And this bill just picks out one of these violent, traumatic, very bad, disastrous crimes and picks this one crime and says, let's double the penalty. And I'm here to say that that would really represent an abandonment of the 30-year guidelines goal of proportionality in sentencing. Again, in this same area, it would make the criminal sexual conduct sentences for first degree disproportionate to the homicide sentences. First degree manslaughter, the sentence is 86 months. So you're talking about a sentence for a sex crime where the victim lives being 3.5 times the sentence for a first-degree manslaughter. It would be just about the same as the sentence for intentional second-degree murder, which other than first-degree murder is the worst homicide that we have in Minnesota. That's 305 months, and this would move CrimSex 1 to 300 months. So you might say, well, you know, these are terrible violent crimes. What's the problem with having high sentences for all of them? Well, of course, the impetus then will be to raise the sentences for second degree and third degree and raise the sentences for all the homicides. And, you know, first degree assault is a pretty bad crime. That's a crime comparable to chopping off somebody's leg with an axe. That's first degree assault. So that's 86 months. Pretty soon you've got a pretty elevated, you know, you look at this and you say, well, in the long run it's only 520 beds for this bill. But you can see how by attempting to maintain the honorable goal of proportionality, where people who do very bad violent crimes nevertheless are sentenced in a proportional way, this is a big step away from that ideal of sentencing. In addition, there's a practical concern. Now, some people believe in the deterrence theory that people who are going to do a violent act think about what could be the consequences to themselves. And for that reason, some of the experts that we heard at the task force 5 years ago said, don't get the criminal sexual conduct sentences too close to the homicide sentences because you're creating a disincentive to allow the victim to live. You could have somebody decide to kill the victim if they're going to get 300 months anyway. And I don't say that to scare people. I know that's a harsh thing to say, but it's a reality in the justice system that ought to be thought about, and it's another reason for proportionality. Two more points in conclusion. One of them is obviously a fiscal point, and I know that this is proposed as a money saver. I'm not sure how many people, by the way, in the treatment program at Moose Lake or St. Peter are there for first degree. Some of them may be there for second degree or repeat third degree crimes. That might help you when you do the fiscal analysis of this. But in any case, Minnesota doesn't have the money to pay for the justice system that we have now. You've been hearing for weeks about how the court system can barely keep its nose above water. The public defenders are trying to keep one nostril above water. So when you're going to expend more resources for one particular crime, it might be good to take a systems approach. And in that regard, I would like to suggest just an alternative way of thinking about this. One of them is to try to balance the prison funding with prevention. And it may not be completely germane to your discussion today, but certainly what Ms. Dunn said is true about prevention. 80% of the crimes in Minnesota, sex crimes in Minnesota, aren't reported. So you get 20 of them reported out of 100, and out of those 20, maybe two of them are successfully prosecuted. And so you get maybe one guy out of 100, and you give him 300 months. That's not a systemic approach to the terrible problem of sexual violence. With respect to how you allocate scarce resources, perhaps if the committee feels that this is a good idea to go ahead, and obviously I'm not too convinced, but if you feel it's a good idea to go ahead, maybe the increase in incarceration for these first-degree criminal sexual conduct offenders could be balanced by, say, a 20% reduction in the sentences for nonviolent property and drug offenders. Because Minnesota has demonstrated that we cannot afford to keep ratcheting up the prison sentences one crime at a time every year, even though these are I'm not here to say these aren't horrible, terrible crimes, but we can't keep raising the sentences one at a time, and you never take a look and say, well, look, here's a guy who's doing 86 months for possession of cocaine. Maybe we could give this person only 60 months for possession of cocaine, and that would free up some bed space for some of these violent guys. I appreciate that you're letting me stray from the path a little bit, but I've been looking at this situation for a long time, and I can't completely disattach in my mind the discussion about nonviolent drug offenses and the discussion of these violent sex offenses. And I just hope that the committee will help Minnesota to achieve a proportional, balanced system once again, rather than to take one crime that affects really under 100 offenders and double the sentence, and in the process tear the fabric of the Minnesota sentencing guidelines and abandon the quest for proportionality.
Thank you, Mr. Stewart. Senator Scheid?
Madam Chair, I just want to say I pretty much agree with what Mr. Stewart has said in terms of the proportionality issue. I mean, I agree. And in terms of other kinds of offenses, possession, for example, drug possession, I concur wholeheartedly. This bill, though, the focus is on increasing the punishment for a very heinous crime. I obviously can't solve all of the issues that he raises here, but I think we do need to take into account the Crimsex 2 and 3. I understand that at some point it doesn't make sense. And I also understand the concern with homicide. And I'm looking at a chart, but I'd like Mr. Kennedy to be able to respond as well. But I just want you to know I pretty much agree.
Thanks for letting me come talk.
Well. Senator Olson? Thank you.
I invited you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Scheid. And thanks really for bringing this forward to our attention, because I think, this is something that we've been discussing in one aspect or another for ever since I've been in the legislature, and that there's an issue here that really needs to be addressed and dealt with. So to the extent that Min Casa brought that up, I agree. And I guess I'm just wondering, it seems like there's some potential different ways to go about doing this. One way we used to handle this when I was in the military a long time ago, for these kinds of cases, was in the sentencing phase, there would be a lot of attention paid to the type of offense, whether they considered it a situational offense or somebody with a predatory orientation, a pedophile or a sociopath or whatever. I mean, the really bad guys that probably are never going to be counseled effectively, at least in the opinion of what I recall from that time. And those people would be given a lot longer sentence. There was discretion in the court, and the sentences were handed out accordingly. And it isn't even as much punishment. It's just keeping them out of society. I mean, not that punishment isn't also appropriate, but the point was we don't want these people out where they can hurt someone else. And we're probably not going to change them, and so we just want to keep them locked up as long as we can. Another approach seems to be what the County Attorneys Association is talking about, some kind of a mandatory minimum, and then we take a look partway through the sentence and determine whether to expand the sentences or not. And then we have the approach of just making a decision, like your bill does. We're going to double this sentence for one group, but then we have issues about, proportionality, and those are good points. So, And in terms of these different approaches, I'm not sure exactly what constitutional issues might be raised in handling things one way versus another. As far I guess I'm not just quite sure. But my overall question is, can we do this quickly, or should this be done, you know, with some longer thought, so that perhaps coming back next year we'd have a bigger picture approach to this? I don't know the answer to that, but I know that the issue that came up in the bonding bill over Moose Lake seems to have, you know, driven a reaction, and I don't think we should knee-jerk anything. I think we ought to really think this through, and I agree with the concept of locking up the serious offenders for a longer period of time, or however we get there. So that's just the input that I have. I'm not sure what the best way to go is here, but I do think we have to make some changes. And I'm also interested to know what other states are doing in terms of lengths of sentences. That's kind of as an aside.
And Senator Scheid?
And Madam Chair and Senator Olson, I know we do. Mr. Kennedy shared some of that information. I asked him about that earlier, and he can share some information on that with you. It isn't – certainly the chair is not – you know, we're not, or, and I agree, we're not moving the bill today. We have to have these thoughtful discussions. But I think there is some pressure to move in this direction, which I think, and I probably should have said that I think Senator Olson is going to replace Senator Higgins as a co-author, not because Senator Higgins wanted to be off, but Senator Olson wanted to be on. So,
Madam Chair,
Mr. Kennedy,
yes, members, I think we've unfortunately gotten very far afield of this bill and what the issue is here. We are talking about very serious sex offenders, and an 8-year presumptive sentence is not enough. And this discussion of proportionality, John, I respect your position, but I do not recall in the 30 years that you've been investigating this, the Public Defender's Office banging down the door to increase sentences. And let me tell you what our sentencing history in Minnesota has been like. From 1980 to 1989, for a CSC1 offense, I'm talking rape of children, forcible rape, power rapists, you got 43 months. From 1989 to 2000, that was raised to 86 months after some high-profile offenses in the metro area. Finally, in 2000, with Katie's Law, we got somewhere close to where things should be, where we are currently with a 12-month presumptive in 8 years. But I submit, ladies and gentlemen, that is still far afield from what these heinous offenses require. And this proportionality issue, if people are concerned about raising CSC2 and CSC3, let's do it. And let's look at the unintentional murder offenses and let's raise them, because CSC1 is a serious offense. We need to raise it to 300 months, and if the water has to rise with everything else, I think that's fine. But this issue is getting clouded today. This bill is addressing very serious sex offenders, and 8 years is not enough. Now, what's happening in other states? Wisconsin has a 25-year mandatory minimum sentence for sexual assault against a child under age of 12 or repeat same assaults. They also include sexual assault under 13 with great bodily harm. That's a life sentence. There's a mandatory 25 years in Wisconsin for a CSC1-like offense with someone under 12 or someone under 16 with force. This bill would bring us into line with Wisconsin. Iowa, there's a mandatory 7/10 required for a person to serve what is the mandatory maximum there, 25-year sentence. So what that equates to is that in Iowa, you get 17 and a half years in a facility for comparable offenses. North Dakota provides a 20-year mandatory minimum sentence for gross sexual imposition against a child under 15. We're talking under 13 here. South Dakota provides a minimum 15-year sentence for the rape of a child under 13. Illinois, if you're 17 years or older, you're looking at a maximum of 60 years. The advisory sentence in those situations is somewhat less, 30, 25 years, but they have a maximum 60 years. In Indiana, for a felony Class A, sentencing range is 20 to 50 years for specified sex crimes. And if you, in Indiana, commit CSC1 with a victim under 14 and you use force or you're over 21 or there's an injury or controlled substance, 30 years. So we are not addressing this sentence appropriately in Minnesota, and we need to raise it, and it's serious. Some of the other comments that were made. The parade of horribles about the murder. I don't know how accurate it is when someone's committing one of these rapes of a child that they're actually going to think, well, I need to kill this child. I don't know if that's realistic or not. I don't know if that goes through the mindset of someone, especially when these are a lot of times crimes of opportunity. If we're concerned about that, then we should look at raising the murder offenses as well.
Mr. Kennedy, how did we arrive at the 300 number?
Well, that's 25 years, and that brings us up to a lot of what other states are doing. And I don't know what evidence you need to realize that 8 years is an inappropriate sentence for these offenses. I don't know what we have to do with an evidence-based system to provide for that. Evidence in other states is showing that they're treating these crimes a whole lot more seriously.
Well, Mr. Kennedy, we're very smart, thoughtful people in Minnesota. And we don't make decisions rashly, but we ask tough questions, and we make sure that the policies that we pass, even if they are for really bad rapists, that as the Judiciary Committee, we ask the proper questions, because we are still functioning under constitutional constraints. So I think it's appropriate that committee members are asking some tough questions. I think that Mr. Stewart's testimony is appropriate for discussion. And I think that it is not sufficient to say that just because other states are doing it, we should do it too, even though we like to look at trend lines. But Minnesotans have always been independent in the way that we enact public policies, and that's always put us at the forefront because we have been independent. So I think that it's appropriate for us to have this discussion. I just, along that same line, I'm wondering if part of the reason why I asked you that question at the beginning is that I was under the impression that one of the category of peoples who are captured in the first degree were the age difference, or kind of the status offenses with the age difference. And I mean, I think reasonable people may differ on how they view that. I guess in my mind, I sort of categorize the violent rapists in a different category, or that kind of an incident. I categorize that a little bit differently from a 15-year-old victim, perhaps with a teacher or stepfather. Not that that is not bad, but if the intent here is to look at the, I mean, in terms of degrees, if it's to look at the degree of how terrible it is, I'm throwing out for discussion that, you know, do we weigh, if we're focusing solely on the first degree, you know, as a matter of public policy, do we weigh the same violent rapist, the same violent rape case in the same category as this statutory, or this situation involving, say, a 15-year-old victim and a stepfather, you know, as bad as it is. So, I mean, I just want to throw out there for discussion. I mean, when I asked you the question,
Madam Chair and members, and let me say, I welcome the tough questions.
Yeah.
We do need to discuss this thoroughly. And yes, there's not an interest in catching the consensual sex between Bobby and Susie in high school and some of these age difference crimes. That's something that has to be considered. So, yes, I understand. We need to ask the tough questions and thoroughly discuss this, but I just wanted to maintain the focus on how serious these crimes are.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair and Mr. Kennedy, and I guess I got a little bit taken aback by what you said, because I'm assuming that you are appropriately passionate about this issue. But you almost sort of implied that the rest of us weren't. And I don't think that's what you meant to imply, but that was a little bit how it sounded.
I apologize if that is how it came across, members. Yeah. I am passionate about it, and I did not mean to insinuate that.
Right, because, Madam Chair, I really think it's our responsibility here to come up with a policy that works all the way around and is well thought through and rational and defensible under the Constitution, and figure out how we're going to pay for it and all of those things. You know, we have an overall responsibility as a legislature to think through a policy, and then if we're going to be enhancing penalties dramatically, to look at everyone who's included in that thing and say, does this make sense, and compare it to other sentences. I just think that's our job. And then the best way to get there, as I said before, is it just with an automatic, this is the highest sentence for everybody and this is what they're going to get, or should we be looking at it at the beginning and differentiating sentences based on different kinds of criminals or partway through? I mean, these are all legitimate possibilities that are put forth by people who don't disagree with your underlying premise, but are just looking at what's the best way to get there.
Senator Scheid, what is the impact of this? If the bill becomes law, or maybe Mr. Kennedy, what is the impact? What's the bad impact?
Madam Chair, do you mean the fiscal impact? And I don't know.
520
may have. It's a two-page.
Mr. Kennedy?
Yeah, Madam Chair, members, there's no impact until 2016. That will be a four-bed. In 2016, that will be a four-bed impact at a cost, estimated cost of $58,000. Chris Dodge from the Department of Corrections is in the audience and could answer more of the questions about possible impacts on DOC.
Okay. Members, I know that this is we're not the budget committee, but Senator Higgins is in the room. I think that we should just, it's part of the discussion. And so, Senator Higgins, I hope you don't mind that we're asking the impact question. Mr. Dodge?
She's not the one that makes the decision, but it happens to be in my division. So we'll let you know when that's
Mr. Dodge?
Madam Chair, my name is Chris Dodge. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Corrections. And we have put together some preliminary figures on here. I do want to caution we have not received a fiscal note, so they're not considered final or formal. But Mr. Kennedy is right. Based on the projections by the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, in 2016 there would be a bed impact of four beds at the cost of $58,000. That will gradually increase until 2036, where the eventual bed impact will be 520 beds at a cost of approximately $12 million at that time.
So, Mr. Dodge, if somebody got convicted under this law when, say, they're, 20 years old, and once they've served perhaps, 16, 15 years, or let's say the full 25, when they get out, they would potentially be eligible for civil commitment depending on where they're at, right?
That is correct. The length of time they have to serve in prison is over, then they may be referred for civil commitment.
And do we have a cost estimate on that?
I don't want to speak for the Department of Human Services. What I can tell you is our preliminary data shows about 15% of these offenders would be referred for civil commitment.
Okay.
Or
so
would actually become civilly committed, I'm sorry.
Okay. And that percentage really wouldn't change if we were to release them earlier, release them later. So it's just keeping them in corrections longer for the 15 or so percentage that would get captured by civil commitment anyways.
That is correct. And because, it's a small percentage of the total, but because the DOC cost is significantly less than the cost in DHS, there would be some savings for that group of offenders.
And then speaking of savings, Mr. Kennedy, I wanted to ask you about that because in the press release that was that we had, it said that the proposal would save money, and I wondered if you could speak to that. Would there be an immediate savings?
There would not be an immediate savings. There's no impact until 2016.
Okay.
And I would like to invite, if possible, also there's some representatives from the Minnesota Sex Offender Program here to talk about the impact on MSOP and the possible how that could this bill could stem the flow of some persons into the MSOP program, which is where some of the savings could be realized.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Before the gentleman from DOC leaves the table, what per diem number did you use for these? $58,000 divided by four people is like $14,000, which is significantly less than what I think the per diem per day.
Mr. Dodge?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Senator Higgins. For the per diem, we used our marginal per diem of $63 a day because that is the per diem that we use when we add beds department-wide. And
excuse
me,
did you say 63?
Almost $63.
And your math is bad.
$63.22, I believe, is what we're projecting that will be in 2013 and beyond at this time using current data. And also, these beds are phased in. When we do these projections, we phase them in on a quarterly basis. So it's not four beds for the entire year. We phase them in on a quarterly basis when we do projections.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, it sounds like you wouldn't count one full year for all four beds. You'd be partial year,
right.
Parts of the year for, you know, I suppose, one full year and the rest phase in.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Mr. Dodge.
In this case, for example, four beds, two beds would be phased in for the first quarter, or one bed would be phased in each quarter of the year.
But, Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
$63 times 365 days is $22,995. So that's $23,000 a year. So even if you phase it in, I think you're a little short on one end. And then I'm curious about the $12 million a year at the 2036. Could we assume that the $12 million is the approximate cost for anything past about 450 beds, or kind of is that about where that break-in is or breakout is?
Mr. Dodge?
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, by the time we reach 520 beds, the cost is about $12 million per year. At 500 beds, it's $11.4
million.
So, and as far as your math, I don't have my calculator with me, but I can't confirm or deny what you said.
Well, Madam Chair and Mr.
Senator Higgins,
math was my worst subject, so I'm still trying to figure it out. Thank you.
All right. Welcome to the committee. Senator Scheid?
Madam Chair, I come up with something just under 58,000. So you just divide your first number by four, get four parts, and then do four parts, three parts, two parts, and one part, and you come up with almost 58.
That it? Okay. Thanks.
Sounds small to me, too, but I get it. I'm sorry.
Senator Scheid is a teacher.
And better in math.
And she's a math teacher. Yeah.
That's comforting. Madam Chair and members, Dan Storkamp, the Deputy Director of the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. And I think the question was the impact on the Minnesota Sex Offender Program of this particular bill. We do look at the sentencing guidelines impacts and the Department of Corrections impacts. And as the Senator or Madam Chair points out, there's an eight-year delay in some of the clients leaving the Department of Corrections and coming to us because they're now staying with the Department of Corrections. So they'll eventually come to us and be referred, but it's just kind of that delay given the current statute. When we look at the numbers for like 2016, and there's four individuals,
We can't say all those individuals are going to be referred or committed as sex offenders in our program. If you look at the first 5 years, from 2016 to 2020, there's a 28-bed impact for the program or for Department of Corrections. We'll get a portion of those that won't be coming to us that could be as high as 10 to 18 range. And, again, it really depends on what the courts are committing and at what rate. And that's really a difficult to anticipate at this point. We'd have to do some additional analysis, but the courts really – how they use this law becomes the question. So the criminal justice system uses this law becomes the question. The other aspect that you want to look at is long term. The program for MSOP is growing at a rate of 60 to 70 beds per year. We look at between 2016 and 2020, we're seeing 2 to 5 people less per year coming in. So we got a small impact for those first few years. If you take about the next decade, between 2020 and 2030, we'll have a reduction of approximately 20 to 30 during that decade because of the number of individuals being committed in corrections won't be coming to our program. But then when you start talking about the next decade of 2030 to 2040, then we're back down to only five or three or five less. So, again, it is an impact for the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, but it's kind of during that eight-year prorated rate coming in.
So the savings is in the delay of the individuals who could potentially be captured and brought into the civil commitment process. Mr. Storkamp, since we have you at the table, of the individuals who are currently in your system, do you have numbers on how many of them are first-degree offenders and the other degrees?
Madam Chair, we've actually put some numbers together with sentencing guidelines and just recently got that in the last couple hours. As a matter of fact, I'd like to ask the executive director from the sentencing guidelines to also join me up here and talk about the numbers.
If we sure. Can do that. That would be interesting. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, we've actually partnered the last couple of weeks to do a very extensive project in a very short period of time of identifying our clients and trying to identify sentencing guidelines worksheets of their past offenses previous to even going to the Department of Corrections. It's a very long and tedious process, but as a result, we were able to identify about 80% of our clients in with sentencing guidelines data.
Members of the committee, my name is Suzanne Allegro, and I'm the director of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. Basically, from a list of 556 persons committed to the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, we tried to match those offenders to our data. We were able to match 424 to our data and had worksheets available. And then, in addition, we got 62 of the unmatched from the DOC microfilm. Of the 486 offenders, 202, or 42%, had first-degree crim sex conduct in their records. Among the 284 offenders without a first-degree crim sex on their records, 18 had some kind of crim sex conduct.
I'm sorry, Ms. Lego, can you repeat that? I didn't hear because of the conversation.
Sorry. Do you want me to repeat?
The 18% or 18 individuals?
Okay. Among the 284 offenders without a first-degree crim sex on their records, 18 had some kind of crim sex conduct offense, but we could not tell what degree it was, either because it was an offense that predated the crim sex degrees or was from another state. Some of those could be the equivalent of first-degree crim sex. The other thing is, since 2002, some of the first-degree offenses are, when we look at sort of break down the offenses, since 2002, some of the first-degree offenses are still in prison and obviously are not yet, have not yet been considered for civil commitment.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson?
I think you told us how many have first degree then, or or something like first degree, but we didn't hear how many might be second or third. Or
okay. Madam Chair, members of the
Ms.
committee.
Ms. Allegro?
202 had first degree, 221 second degree, 141 third degree, 91 fourth degree, 32 crimsex with an unknown degree, 25 failure to register, 11 child pornography, 21 other sex offense, 136 other person offense, 142 property, 27 drug, 31 other offense, 37 juvenile sex offense, and 52 misdemeanor sex offense.
Madam Chair?
Senator Olson.
Somehow that, so are you saying like a misdemeanor sex offender is being committed and never let out?
Ms. Allegro?
On some of these, that might have been the most recent offense, but they would have had other more serious offenses within their criminal history.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
That might be true, you said, on some of these, but, I mean, I really think we ought to have the big picture on that because, I mean, I don't, what would fourth degree even consist of? And if no one is ever getting out of the program, I'm very much in favor of extending sentences and locking up in prison people who are dangerous criminals and making sure that they're not out reoffending. But I'm also wondering about low-level sentences, if we're paying any attention to whether it's making sense to have those people committed indefinitely or not, you know?
Mrs. Storkamp.
Madam Chair and members, just to clarify, what we're looking at here is any offense on their record. So we said, was there a first degree, not just their previous or conviction to us, but throughout their entire criminal sentence in the sentencing guidelines worksheets. So the numbers that executive director talked about here are a total of, all right, we're not a, they add up more than to our population. So basically first, second, third, they may have multiples.
Right.
It's not a single offense. So we're not breaking it down and saying our 552 are breaking down this way. We're saying, have they ever had a first degree? Have they ever had a second degree? So they could have had the second degree with a misdemeanor with something else in their history.
Senator Olson.
So, Madam Chair, I understand that then, that, but you're still saying only about half of them or less than half of them had a first degree. And so I think it would be helpful to know the highest level of offense. Let's just look at it that way among the remainder of the population to get a feel for, you know, the relative degree of dangerousness of the people that we're putting in a program that's kind of an indefinite civil commitment, it seems like.
Wow. Senator Olson, that's conversation in a separate committee on another day. But this information is really helpful and interesting. Thank you for working so hard on it and getting it to us for our reflection today. Is this information, can this be made available to members of the committee? Ms. Allegro?
Madam Chair, yes, it can. As Mr. Storkamp said, we just basically finished it about 1 o'clock, and so want to make sure it's
Thank
in
you.
A format that would be understandable.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Mr. Storkamp.
If I could just make two additional comments about the bill itself and
sure.
the impact on the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. If we are getting clients, once they're done with the corrections, 8 years later, we do have a program of our assisted living unit that has been growing for us. And I think one of the things that we'd be looking at down the road is if our clients are coming in on an average of 8 years older, we might have additional health care costs as the Department of Corrections has been dealing with that same issue. In addition, I think the other aspect that we don't know yet is if they have 8 years longer in the Department of Corrections, we do have a program jointly with Department of Corrections on providing sex offender treatment while their clients in the facilities. And we don't know if that would have an impact and not have them come to us if they complete that with it in that additional 8 years. So I think there's a lot of additional debate, as you said, Madam
sure.
Chair, around all these areas.
Incidentally, Ms. Allegro, you know the cat, the 200-some individuals that are first degree. Were you able to get a further breakdown of what the different convictions were for that first degree? What's the largest population in that, in the first degree population that you have?
For the offender sentenced between, Madam Chair, excuse me, for the offender sentenced between 1991 and 2008, The largest number would be those that were convicted under 609.324 subdivision 1A, the victim under 13, the actor 3 years or older, and that would be 61. So that's the largest.
What was that?
So does that I think that was the group that I was referring to earlier. That's in the first degree category. Senator Olson?
So, Madam Chair, that would be like, say, for example, a 12-year-old and a 16-year-old would fall into that category?
Ms. Allegro?
Madam Chair?
Senator Foley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tell me what the per diem is in your people in your whatever you...
Is it Mr. Storkamp?
Yes.
Mr. Storkamp.
Madam Chair, Senator Foley and committee members, our current per diem is $328 a day.
Yeah, so it's, Madam Chair, substantially more than what the $53 or whatever the per diem was on that.
Ms. Allegro, can you answer Senator Olson's question?
So, Madam Chair, I guess what I'm saying is, for example, that could be a 12-year-old and a 16-year-old. That would be the highest percentage of your first-degree offenders. I mean, not necessarily saying that they were those ages, but it could be that kind of a situation.
Yeah, the victim would have been, Madam Chair, members of the committee, yeah, the victim would have been under 13, and then the actor would have been at least, 3 years older.
So even 15, perhaps.
No, the victim has to be under the age of 13.
Right, but the perpetrator could be 15 years old, for example.
Madam Chair.
Correct. Senator Schott.
Madam Chair, I think it would be interesting to know how many offenders were teenagers, or I'm not sure which age to ask about, up to eight, maybe less than 18, perhaps, or less than 16, or 16 or less. But do you have numbers on those people in your program who committed these offenses when they were teenagers? Now, I understand there may be they may have multiple offenses and other issues. I just was curious.
Well,
to know that number,
Ms. Allegro, do you have that information, or Mrs. Storkamp?
Madam Chair and members, that's some of what we just begin to start digging into with our data here. So the first time we've ever matched up sentencing guidelines data to our data, and we're excited about seeing the results because I think we can help guide some of the policies with the information that we've got here and guide some of the areas we're moving towards. But we don't have much knowledge in working with this yet. So
okay.
I think we can, but I'm not sure what we've got there.
My compliments to you for doing that, and please continue, because I think this is very helpful information. Senator Olson?
Well, Madam Chair, and I guess I think that's really helpful information, too, because I'm not sure whether Mr. Kennedy agrees, but it just seems like most of us would look at this and say there's a difference between someone who's 15 years old and commits a crime that we want to deter, but probably isn't going to be the same level of danger to society, getting out, reoffending, the counseling and can prevent that kind of thing. It was a situational kind of circumstance as opposed to the person who's a pedophile that preys on people and then, causes, is going to continue to be a danger to society, and we want to keep them locked up as long as possible. And it seems to me like that's why it's important that we look at the whole picture here rather than just kind of quickly making a decision.
And Senator Olson, I don't think that that's the direction we're going, and that's why we're getting multiple opportunities to have this discussion. The hour is late. We, first of all, it's really great to have this panel of individuals who've done a lot of work here to answer some of the questions. So I'm really grateful that you made the time, and I know you're all missing your dinner hours, and I'm grateful. But I know that it's late, and members of the committee, we've gone way beyond our time. And so unless anybody has questions that they absolutely have to ask, I'm sure Ms. Allegro, Mr. Storkamp, Mr. Kennedy, Mr. Stewart, Mr. Dodge are all available. Ms. Dunn and Minkasa, they're all available for individual conversations if we all have a further conversation. And then when we do schedule the bill, we'll have all of you back, and we can ask other questions. So, Mr. Storkamp?
Madam Chair, members, I apologize, but I think it's just real important to remember that Our civil commitment program isn't necessarily based on a past offense or offenses they've got. It could have been charged offenses. It could be a whole slew of other factors. We had an average of 17 victims for our population that we've looked at in our clientele so far. So we're not looking necessarily at the low-level offenders that end up in our program. It is the more severe, but I think the information we can help with will really help you guys. Right.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Senator Scheid. Thank you.
Yeah, Chair, thank you for this good hearing.
We are adjourned.
Thank you. Thank you. When you say 17, you have to